I'm able to report that Edison Carter was pulled off the air. The incident has not gone public.
Are we certain the incident was connected with the blip advertisements?
Not yet.
It won't be so simple if news of this leaks out. My God.
Come on, Ben. The only people that inactive are pensioners, the sick, or the unemployed. I mean, who really cares?
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, where we got our name for being booted off the local community radio by the Bristol Mafia here in the shape of a man called Pat Hart, who now works for the BBC. He got promoted for his trouble, and it is Friday the 17th of November 2023. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. On the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on our very own Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. And I gave you the wrong app store last week. I don't know why I did that. I think it's actually called Horizon, which is absolutely wonderful. The idea is here. You don't have to log in. Sorry, it's not Horizon. It's, guess what it's called? It's Aurora, A-U-R-O-R-A. Aurora Store. And if you go to their website, you can download an app store which is just the same as Google Play, but you don't have to register, you don't have to log in, you can download it anonymously, and you can also download the uncensored apps that Google don't censor. So Aurora's the place to be. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for joining us and turning off the psycho in the corner. Joining us instead, gaslighting us with its military grade propaganda psyops. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for Gaza, for humanity and against the pre-war lies. What an extraordinary thing it was to see Crispin Blunt right at the beginning of all this being arrested after saying that maybe the Prime Minister should be watch out that he doesn't get arrested for colluding with war crimes going on in Gaza. Poor old Crispin Blunt. But I mean, that's what they're doing nowadays. It's basically like a gang. And look, a new member of the gang. David, well, he's not very new, is he? David Cameron. The accelerationist strategy is clear to anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear. The so-called solutions to every crisis, climate, migrant, COVID, economic, Ukraine, Gaza, are not designed to make things any better as the mass media is spinning them. They're Armageddonist policies designed to make everything worse. So anyway, helping us navigate through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also from very much here in Bristol, that's Bristol for Palestine, it's Bushrat Ali. And also we'll be joined on the line from Richmond in London by Nick Georges from Palestine Action. King's speech, we had that last week, but in part one and part two this week we'll be looking at particularly at the appointment of David Cameron and what that might mean for Britain's foreign policy. How did on earth did that happen? We'll be taking also a brief look at the national news story about Bristol this week with the Tuesday's monthly full meeting of the full council just about to start, when everyone's told, oh, there's going to be no meeting with the full council because there's been a problem. We found a problem that's been sitting there for 50 or 60 years in a tower block, and we're going to evacuate the whole tower block right now, even though this problem has been there for 50 years, because we don't really want to have a council meeting, thank you very much, and we can put things off, because the mayor anyway is over in Rwanda. He's not even here in the city. He's doing some sort of globe-trotting trick. In part two, something especially for Martin, which is some fascinating insight from the Russian military, a colonel in the Russian military, talking about what a nuclear war with the United States might look like, and also, we'll be hearing from, as I promised last week, I'd have a go, and of course he was very obliging, it's David Livingstone, talking about the esoteric origins of Zionism, this whole project. So, maybe we could start by hearing a little bit from Richmond down the line on Skype. Nick, what's your take on what's been going on over the last month in Gaza? Because this is an issue that you've been on for many years, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. Well, it's horrific. I think we're all absolutely shocked and horrified about it.
Are you really that shocked? Because you've been on this program before, saying that the Israelis have got a genocidal policy towards the Palestinians, and I mean that seems to have been borne out by the facts.
Yes, but I don't think we've seen it quite on this scale before, and quite as blatantly, obviously. I mean, you know, the Israel has locked up 2.5 million Palestinians in this tiny area of Gaza. They've surrounded them with electronic surveillance, deeply entrenched electronic fences to try and stop tunneling. There's walls, there's automatic gun turret points all along the wall, and they're surrounded by the Israeli army at sea, by the Israeli navy, and from the air they're bombed by the Israeli air force. And I mean, in 2008, as Operation Cast Lead, Israel does what it does occasionally. It calls it mowing the lawn. So every couple of years it goes in and just does indiscriminate bombing of Gaza. In 2008, they had an indiscriminate little lawn mowing session, and they killed 1,800 Palestinians, mainly civilians and women. And it's funny, there was no uproar, there was no outrage about this terrorist act. It wasn't even mentioned in the press. 2014, they had another little lawn mowing session again. And this time they bombed and murdered 2,600 Palestinians. I think over 1,000 children. They use white phosphorus regularly. And these 2,600, nothing again was ever said about that. There was no outrage, no horror stories about terrorists or anything. And inevitably, you know, if you lock that number of people up in those horrendous conditions and you don't let them out, you let barely survival amounts of food in, very tightly controlled. You completely control the water, so 90% of the drinking water in Gaza is undrinkable. You limit their electricity to 2 to 3 hours a day. The hospitals all have to try and run on generators. You shoot their fishermen out of the water in your navy at sea. You bomb them from the air. You constantly surveil them with drones 24 hours a day. You shoot them from behind the security fences with your snipers. And when they try and have a march of return inside their gates, snipers shoot their legs off. And the result is that I think Gaza has got over 6 football teams of one-legged football players. And they're the lucky ones, those are the strong ones that survived. If you treat any group of people to that sort of bestiality, you are going to have kickbacks. You've got to expect trouble of some sort somewhere down the line. And their response to that trouble, which many believe they knew, were well warned about in advance. Egypt apparently warned them about it. Israel has the most highly skilled technical surveillance system in the world. And many people think it very strange that Israel had no idea what was going on. And so, yes, that happened. And I think it's hardly surprising. But I mean, the results of this horrific invasion, this bombing now, I mean, if I can just briefly read something from the Good Shepherd Collection, a charity. Briefly, over the last 40 days, Israel has killed over 11,450 Palestinians with murderous airstrikes, with the mass bombings of residential areas and the intentional targeting of hospitals and clinics. The US-backed Israeli military has killed over 4,700 children. It is estimated that some 3,640 people are trapped under the rubble. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports that as many as 1,777 of children are buried under broken concrete and twisted rebar. Many Palestinians are being forced by gunpoint to leave behind their homes in northern Gaza and march down the road en masse as Israel executes its next phase of ethnic genocide and forced population transport. So this latest little exploit of Israel's is no longer, even they wouldn't call it mowing the lawn. This is barefaced barbaric genocide and ethnic cleansing. They're now going to force these people to leave Gaza. They're possibly going to force march them into the middle of the Sinai Desert, where they're talking about putting up tented cities for them. And this basically was the end game all along.
Well, look, Nick, it's interesting to hear all this stuff from your perspective. What about action that's being taken against the Israelis in Britain? Because we've got this bizarre situation where the British government seems to be going along with this. I mean, we've just had last weekend the service of commemoration, Remembrance Day service, and yet there's the British government shaking hands with the Israelis in a genocide.
Yes, well, the problem we have is that, I don't know, you probably don't remember, but when Liz Truss was vying to become Prime Minister, before she actually got in, she put out this huge pledge of allegiance to Israel. And I remember thinking, why would anyone want to become British Prime Minister put out this pledge to Israel? And lo and behold, she left. And then just before Richie Sunak became Prime Minister, he again put out this identical pledge of allegiance to Israel. I thought, why would he do that if he wants to become British Prime Minister? No other country in the world, just Israel. The British government makes a lot of money out of selling arms to Israel. It makes a huge amount of money from it. Israel has got 10 armaments factories. The largest Israeli manufacturer of weapons is called Elbit. And Elbit manufacture 85% of Israel's weapons. Drones, bombs, rifles, you name it. 85% of their weaponry are manufactured by Elbit. Elbit now have 9 factories in England making these weapons. These weapons are exported directly to Israel to kill the Palestinians. So I was out in the West Bank for 3 months, and I saw for 3 months on a daily basis, I witnessed the atrocities and the horrors committed by the Israeli army.
Nick, but what did you see?
Well, one of the worst things I saw, I was taken to this house, this incident happened 2 years previously, where a family of 4 Palestinians, a mother, a father, a 4-year-old boy and a baby, 12 Israeli settlers, extremist settlers, came down in the middle of the night with an incendiary device. They lobbed it through the window and the family woke up on fire. The mother grabbed the baby out of the cot. They rushed outside only to discover that they were still burning because there was white phosphorus in this incendiary device. The mother had grabbed the blankets in a rush to get out and not got the baby.
No, well, look, I mean, I don't mean to be mean to you, Nick, but you didn't actually see this happening, did you? This was several years before you got there. I mean, what did you witness, you know, as someone that visited there, what did you witness for yourself?
Well, I was sent to the West Bank, and what we did, we witnessed time and time again the demolition of Palestinian homes. For example, there was a shepherd, an elderly shepherd and his wife in a little village called Susia with his sheep. And the Israeli army came down, 25 soldiers with a bulldozer, and they demolished his tent and his shepherd holding. 4 times, this man got another tent, he got some more sheep, he came back. And on the 4th time, I videoed this whole thing. The army came down again, and this time all he had a little box, which was about 5 foot long by about 2 foot high, just big enough for him and his wife to squeeze into, to lie under, out the sun. He put 4 posts up with a tarpaulin over it to keep the sun off his sheep. Again, the Israeli army have come down, destroyed everything. And I've got a lovely video of the head DCO of the Israeli army talking very angrily to this man in Hebrew, not so he could understand it. It was translated to me later by Beth Salem. But what she was saying was, 4 times I've come down to demolish your home. 4 times you've come back. If you come back once more, you will be given a black spot and your whole family will be issued with this black spot. And basically that means that they will never get any permits to move ever again. They won't be allowed into Israel to work. And it's almost like a death sentence.
And it means also maybe that they won't be able to join the Freemasons. Anyway, look, I'm also joined in the studio by Bushrat Ali from Bristol's Palestine Action. Hi, Bushrat. Can you just tell us why you got involved in this Palestine campaign?
Okay. My name is Bushrat Ali, easy for your audience to understand. And I am involved with the Palestine campaign from 2004. And we set up the group called Bristol for Palestine to organize the protest, because there are so many wonderful people and organization. They are working as individuals or organization in a different, under the different banners. But as this is a common cause for Palestine, so we decide let's invite all the organizations, individuals, schools, colleges, and all the students in under one banner. So when we will do the protest, it will call the Bristol for Palestine.
Okay,
it
so, will, I mean, most of us know that what the horrors that have been going on out there. We're now around about 12,000 innocent civilians have been killed by the Israelis in this genocide so far over the last 5 weeks. But what's been going on here in Bristol?
First of all, they are not 12,000, they are more than a 12,000. 12,000 numbers we get from the Israeli media, as you can understand, Palestine do not have independent...
Actually, no, the numbers are coming, a lot of them are coming from the Palestinians, but they have been saying that because of the electricity outages and the communications, they can't guarantee that these are correct figures. They are are lower than the true total, so I take your point.
They are more than 12,000 pounds. That's what we have understanding. And secondly, about the Bristol are doing amazing for a Palestine, as always doing. I am engaged with the Bristol Palestine campaign from 2004. Every time when anything happened in a Palestine, we come on the road and we put pressure and we play our role to organize protest. And this is who we done this time in 2013, 7th of October, when something happened. We came on the road for a single slogan that we do not want a war. We need a ceasefire. Whoever is killing innocent people, regardless their color, culture, or their religion, we stand for our humanity. That's what we done. We done, I believe, and media calling, we done one of the biggest protests in Bristol history, where was more than 30,000 people, which is we believe was engaged for Palestine. So that's what Bristol stand for, and we call that Bristol stand for humanity, justice, peace, and regardless their color, culture, or their religion. We are not against any culture. We are not against any religion. This is your audience need to take away with tonight. We are just standing for humanity. We are just standing for justice.
But there's been quite a lot of different protests, haven't there? Even school children.
Yeah.
What have they been doing?
Because we all know that more than 3,000 children been killed and more than 500 newborn baby they killed in last few weeks. And especially yesterday, they bomb attack on a hospitals. They killed more than 500 people about weeks ago in a hospitals. So Israeli army killing anyone. They are killing, they are attacking, they are not following any rule of war. And secondly, this is not a war. This is a one-side war. So even the war rule is not implement on this situation. They are not following any international law for a war. They are killing innocent people regardless where they are, what they are. Let's be very clear. Let's suppose we agree with the claim of the Israel, they said there was a terrorist hiding in our hospital, then they shouldn't be attacking on the situation in a hospital. They have to understand the hospital was engaged with more than thousands of people. Hospital was using as a refugee center. There was an innocent citizen, and they should wait, and they can use some other tactic to bring the terrorist out, as they claim. But they did not bother to wait. They did not stop killing innocent people. They did not realize this is a hospital and this is against the international rule of war.
I mean, there are British Jews that say that they're very nervous and worried. They feel threatened by the protests going on in Britain.
No, I am not agree with this, because this is what something ex-home minister or foreign minister bring in a public view, that this is we are doing hate crime.
Suella Braverman, she's talking about hate marches.
Yes, hate marches. And we are not doing any hate marches. We are just simply saying, let's bring the peace. And when we invite for a people for a peace, there is not only a Muslim killing in a Palestine. There is a Jews, there is a non-Muslim, there is a Christian, there is a Sikh, Hindu. So when the Israel attack killed, they do not understand who they are killing. They are just killing the people who are staying in a Palestinian land. So Palestinian land not only belonging to the Muslim. So they are killing all kind of people. It's not make different of the number that 100 Muslim will kill or one Jews will kill.
Okay, no. Well, let's just look at the protests last weekend, particularly, well, actually, it was the protest on Saturday, and then we had Remembrance Sunday the day after with the ceremony at the Cenotaph with the King, the politicians, the representatives of the Commonwealth, all outside the Cenotaph. Martin, maybe you could just bring you in on this, because it was a whole week of advertising for that. I mean, I suppose the Palestine Solidarity Movement must be rather pleased with the mainstream press advertising last Saturday's march all week for the previous week. So you've got a very good turnout, roughly 750,000 people, somewhere between the different estimates. So, Martin, what do you make of what happened? Because actually the police did a fairly good job, didn't they? They actually nabbed a bunch of about 80 people from the far right who were attempting, a little hit squad, attempting to attack the march.
Well, they weren't even attempting to attack the march. They were attempting to march to the Cenotaph. So they were actually disrupting the ceremony.
So maybe you didn't see this, but they showed on Channel 4 News that evening, they showed that Corrigh O'Brien was showing that there was a bunch of the far-right activists who were attempting to get to the march, and the police just arrested them in the next-door street to stop them getting there.
Yeah, but I mean, the other thing that they were doing earlier in the day, yeah, where most of them was arrested, was trying to march on the Cenotaph, where people are trying to have a dignified ceremony. And it wasn't the pro-Palestinian protesters who were disrupting the ceremony. It was these right-wing crazies. But in Bristol last Sunday, not last Sunday, but the Sunday before, Bristol for Palestine organised a march here in Bristol, yes, didn't they?
Yeah.
Now, is there anything happening this weekend, Ali?
Yes. First of all, let me answer your question. Bristol have a long-standing history, not only Bristol, and British government and British people have a long-standing history for stand for justice. We give our parents give, your parents give, nation of our country, they give a long sacrifice to bring the Bristol, bring the Europe, bring the UK where we are right now. We have a long-standing history to sacrifice to bring this state that people call us a democratic country. People call us a champion for the human rights. And that's we are bringing back for our nation, that what we want to be a represent our nation, that we are champion for human rights. That's the reason more than 1 million people take the part on the same day to for a Palestine. So that is, I think, that was a great achievement for all the British people, not only for our Palestinian supporters, for everyone. And secondly, about the Bristol, yes, it was on the 29th of October, Sunday last month.
Yeah.
It was one of the biggest protests Bristol ever witnessed, and it was a historical event. And that in that protest, if you look at the protest video, or if you look at the protest statement, there was a Muslim, a non-Muslim, Christian, a Sikh, Hindu, and there was all kind of culture and religion was speakers. One of the main speakers was from every culture and from every religion. So that was the beauty of the protest. It was not by leading by the one religion or the one set of the color or culture. Well, it was a mix.
Is there something happening this weekend?
Yeah, it is.
Is it on Sunday or Saturday?
Before I attend your interview, I was outside the AXA company, which is one of the large company investment.
Yeah. Aren't they an insurance company?
Yeah.
AXA, yeah. Bilderberg,
yeah, insurance. They are in one of the largest company investing in Israel. We was doing protest outside their building just right now in a Clifton in Bristol, on a Red Line Road. And secondly, we done a protest outside, not only the city center. We done the protest outside the BBC building, asking them for a fair reporting on a Palestine. We are doing this from the last many years, and that's what we are. That's what the civilized people can do. There is nothing we can achieve. There is nothing we can ask our community to do. That's what we can do. We can approach our MP. Unfortunately, none of our British Bristol MP vote for a ceasefire, and I feel myself.
No, they voted against it, didn't they? No. They didn't even.
They didn't vote.
Okay.
But I have a communication with the few MP in Bristol. And it is shame that they are not agree for a ceasefire. They have a different standing, and that what give
well,
us...
Look, we'll have to back this to Martin, who's a member of the Labour Party, because the nearest, I think, Labour MP that voted for a ceasefire this week in the Commons, it was, I think it was an amendment to the King's Speech debate.
Yeah.
It was in Birmingham. Nobody, even anywhere in the whole of the West Country at all.
Well, I think what happened there is quite interesting, because the Liberal Democrats were on the fence, but they all voted for a ceasefire because they can see the way the wind is blowing in terms of public
opinion.
Normally,
let's just spell it out, because normally issues of conscience like this are given a free vote. They're not whipped. They're not threatened with the sack if they vote with their conscience.
Well, I think Starmer has made it a matter of confidence, because he is essentially a part of the establishment. The Labour Party is a strange beast. It's got one foot as part of the establishment.
Well, he's an authoritarian, isn't he? And he's also very much a big friend of Israel.
Well, he is, and I think this the politics of this have got quite interesting, because obviously the Conservative Party are very pro-Israel, and many of, apart from people like Crispin Blunt, who is a minority within their party, but of course he's a very much a lone voice. All the opposition parties in the United Kingdom voted for a ceasefire, and that includes the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists, the Welsh Nationalists, the Alliance Party in Northern Ireland, who are a cross-party party, but they are mainly Protestant, and also the SDLP, who are a Nationalist party, and of course Sinn Féin would have voted against, but they don't take their seats in the Parliament. So it's there's a clear divide happening now in British public opinion between a Conservative rump, which includes the Labour leadership, and everybody else. And if you look at the opinion polls, it's quite clear 70%, 75% want a demand for a ceasefire. And of course, Macron in France has made the demand for a ceasefire, and lots of other countries have as well.
Of course.
So Britain is actually out of step.
We will be looking at the part two of this programme at some of the reasons for that, the United States and Britain. It was on Press TV earlier this week, and the presenter asked a very good question. He said, what's in it for the Americans? What's in it for the British? Why are they supporting this genocide? And we'll be addressing that question later on. But before that, let's have a listen to last night's BBC Question Time with one of our local MPs, Jacob Rees-Mogg, giving his opinion on whether or not there should be a ceasefire.
Is it a collective punishment or elimination of terrorism?
It is an attempt to eliminate terrorism. The gentleman there with the glasses made absolutely the right point. What do people expect Israel to do after 1,400 of her people were massacred? A ceasefire is a victory for Hamas, because they will carry on. As Juliet said, they will not obey it. And to come to the hospital specifically, I'm going to quote from the Times, because I think it's important to look at this properly in terms of the Geneva Convention. Article 18 states that in no circumstances should a hospital treating the sick and wounded be the object of attack. Article 19 says that such protection ceases if the hospital is being used to commit acts outside its humanitarian remit. And the hospital, we have known since 2007, by a report from Human Rights Watch, that said that Hamas had fired a rocket at its Palestinian rival Fatah from the complex. And in 2015, Amnesty International, not a friend of the Jewish state, not a friend of the British government, said that International reported that the group used an empty outpatient clinic on the site to interrogate and torture people suspected of collaborating with Israel. So Hamas has been using the protection of a hospital to carry out terrorist-inspired interrogations and actions of terror. What are the Israelis supposed to do?
Jacob,
what would the British government do? What would we ask our armed forces to do if there were a hospital being used in some part of the United Kingdom as a base for terrorist outrages? We would, of course, send in our forces to stop it. And there is a dreadful moral equivocating about defending the right of Israel to protect itself from these evil attacks.
Danny. Jacob, I don't think anyone's questioning the right of... I don't think the question here is about the right of Israel to defend itself. It's about humanitarian law, and I'm glad you brought it up, because that same article talks about everything feasible needing to be done before a hospital is targeted, that the combatants must take precautionary measures, and most importantly, must be proportionate. You know, the WHO head said earlier this week that a child is dying every 10 minutes in Gaza. Six children in the course of recording of this program. Is that proportionate? Is that the right response
Israel
to what's happened in Israel?
Is providing incubators for newborn babies.
But there's not the fuel to power the incubators.
But what is providing
is that, the
battery-powered
is
ones as it happens? What is proportionate to people who have stored Kalashnikovs in a hospital that they will come out with and shoot you with, and they will cross your border and kill innocent people out of all things, a peace rally? What is proportionate when people are murdering and are preparing to murder? What are you supposed to do? You say you're absolutely right. You made the fundamental point. What do the opponents of Israel expect her to do?
We're here in the green. Hang on, let's get a microphone to you. There you go.
I think it's really interesting that you just said that they're providing incubators when we've just heard that there's no electricity.
They're providing battery ones. So that seems to me that the Israelis are trying to minimise civilian casualties. Of course they are. Dare I say, much more than we tried in the Second World War,
is
when
that how
we
it
were
seems
dealing
to you,
with
Danny?
A fundamental threat to our nation.
Hang on.
So that's Jacob Rees-Mogg, Tory MP, local Tory MP, comparing it to Britain defending itself in World War II. That's what Israel's doing.
I'm not agree what he's saying, to be honest, because that both situations are totally different, and we have to understand this is not a war. Israel not in a war situation. Israel killing the innocent people on a shoulder, making excuse that they are a Hamas supporter or they are a terrorist. They are not. All the media and all the, even he, in his own speech, he mentioned that after every 10 minutes, one children dying in a Gaza. So it means Gaza is become a graveyard for a children. So this is not a war. We have to be very clear, and we have to be agree on this, that this is not a war. And this is a one-side war, which is on innocent Palestinians and innocent citizens.
Well, Nick George, thanks for being patient and waiting there. Can I just get your comment on what you've just heard from Jacob Rees-Mogg, particularly this whole idea that actually Hamas has been supposedly part of this hospital, although I'm not sure that they've produced any evidence from the Israelis. So, well, they have produced is some evidence, apparently, that a body of one of the hostages was found nearby the hospital, although we can't verify that whether or not that was brought there by the Israeli Defence Forces and put there.
Well, I don't know. I'm not in Gaza, so I don't know the situation. But all I can do is give examples of propaganda. For example, President Biden spoke very heatedly about the murder of 40 babies. Now, who persuaded him as the most powerful man in the world to come out with this? I don't know. But it's very interesting that he actually came out and spoke this as though it's absolute truth. And then 2 weeks later, he was forced to walk it back and admit, in all honesty, that there was absolutely no evidence for these 40 babies or a lot of the other stuff that he'd been saying. So there's so much propaganda going on about who's in what hospital, why we blew this hospital up, did the Palestinians blow their own hospital up. There's so much propaganda and lies going about, it's really difficult to know actually what is happening at all.
Martin, can you just tell us what you make of what we've just heard from Jacob Rees-Mogg? He's entirely justifying what the Israelis are doing, and he's most definitely not going to be calling for any kind of ceasefire. He's saying that they have a legitimate right of self-defence, even if tens of thousands of civilians are being killed.
Well, I think it's quite interesting that they referred to this body that they found as a hostage. Now, I understand that this hostage was, in fact, a soldier. Yeah, so it was a female soldier. The Israelis themselves said it's a female soldier's body that they found.
Yeah, she'd been taken to hospital, yeah.
No, she's hostage. Dead.
Ah.
She's dead. But the point is, she's not a hostage, she's a soldier, and therefore a prisoner of war. Most of the people who've been taken as hostages are, in fact, soldiers. And don't forget that the Israeli government is holding thousands and thousands of Palestinians in permanent detention, which is not, they've not been put in front of any court. They're administratively detained for up to 20 years. Now, in other words, we're not dealing with like and like. I mean, if we can argue about the words that we're using, whether it's a war or not a war. If it is a war, then of course it's a one-sided war in one sense. But of course, we talk about the Israelis that have been captured as hostages. The Palestinians aren't even mentioned, but they are hostages of the Israeli state. And in any case, anybody who is a military person on the Israeli side, and that includes virtually every adult, male or female, is in fact a prisoner of war. They're not a hostage, they're prisoners of war, and they're going to be exchanged for Palestinian prisoners of war. And of course, there's no reason why the Israelis should be allowed to say that they've got the right to go into Gaza. Most of the people living in Gaza, their relatives are buried underneath the kibbutzes which were attacked. So in that, their grandparents are buried underneath those kibbutzes.
Sound a bit of
that is their land.
A trite comment, but in a way, isn't this a kind of elaborate land grab? We were hearing from Nick Georges earlier on about settlers stealing land from Palestinians over the years, bit by bit. And this has really accelerated that right up, hasn't it? It's a massive land grab.
Of course, the existence of the State of Israel is a massive land grab. That's what it is. And it was only agreed to in the end because plenty of Israelis engaged in terrorism. The Irgun killed loads of British soldiers. When people go to the armistice memorial to the British war dead, hundreds of those war dead, possibly thousands, were killed by Israeli terrorists who were never punished. They got a state out of that. They were given a state by the British, by the Americans, at the end of World War II, as a reward for the killing of lots of British soldiers and police officers and thousands of Palestinian civilians. Nobody was punished.
Well,
so nothing that Hamas is doing today is any different than Menachem Begin or Yitzhak Shamir did back in the 1940s. And, of course, they killed lots of British soldiers. Their relatives are still alive in this country, killed by Israeli terrorists, not by Palestinians, Israelis.
Well, we were hearing, weren't we, from Gerald Kaufman, that it was Zippy Livni, the former foreign minister of Israel's father, that was behind the blowing up of the King David Hotel, which killed quite a few Jews as well as the British Army. But anyway, Bushra Ali, I know you've been in touch with some of the local MPs. What's their reaction been?
Oh, it is such a shameful. And we had a meeting with a few local MP. I do not want to gave a name, and we have a communication through the email and WhatsApp. But their stand, they said they will not agree for a ceasefire. That bring us on a shock. And I believe me and a few other individuals and groups from the community, we are planning to host the public meeting in the next general election. We will plan to launch our independent candidate, or we will support the people who will represent us. None of the MP, they are agree. We invite them, surprisingly. We invite the, not only the local MP, all the local councillors from all the party, other than Green Party councillors and expecting candidate, none of MPs or none of the Labour Party or Conservative Party, they show up and stand solidarity for Palestine. So for them, they think that these are just a numbers, and they don't bother if more than 11,000 people killed in a Palestine. And one of the local MP, I have a communication with her, and she said, till the Israel not safe, and they will not kill all the terrorists, and they will not achieve all the hostage release, they will not stop the war, they will take revenge. And we are fully support Israel this stance. So that is something, as a British citizen, and especially a voter of the local election, we will think about twice, and we will make sure next MP, they will represent us.
Well, yeah, good luck with that. But Martin, this is a pretty extraordinary position for them to take, isn't it? Saying that it's actually okay to carry on massacring civilians in Gaza, clearing them out like a giant bulldozer out of this massive area of their own land until they give the hostages back.
Well, in 2006, Kerry McCarthy, who's my MP now, I'm now in Bristol East because we've just been switched over in Eastern, she came to the demonstration about what was happening in Gaza. Yeah. She didn't have a problem doing that in those days. But, of course, what's happened since then is the grip of the pro-Zionist lobby in British politics has tightened. Look at the way in which Jeremy Corbyn was run out of town, prevented from
I think,
speaking,
isn't it interesting,
and so on.
Because a lot of this talk that we've had over the last few years about anti-Semitism, this seems to be almost premeditated. The idea is to make sure that there's no supporters of Palestine and all supporters of Netanyahu in the Labour Party.
Well, that's they can say that, but it's not necessarily true. 56 Labour MPs voted against the party leadership.
Can I add one thing? I agree with my colleague. One of the local sitting MP, I do not want them named.
No, that's a shame. I think you should name them.
No, she was requesting and she was begging to speak in one of my protests in 2007. She was one of the main speakers. That time she was a candidate from the one of the local Labour area. No, she's a sitting MP. And then I had a meeting with her a few days back before the protest. And I invite her, will you join me this time as a speaker? She said, no. I said, can I share your old video where you spoken for Palestine more than 30 minutes? She said, no, don't share. That time I was not MP. I said, you was not MP, but you was a candidate. Mm. And that time, for a public, you was agreed to speak. No, you are MP and your feeling
but
is
look,
changed.
Let me tell you, you don't have to ask her for her permission to use the video unless it's her video that she shot. Yes. Who shot the video?
General public, one of our colleagues. And
right, well, in which case you don't need to ask any permission from anybody.
Okay.
So you can, well, it'll be interesting to, maybe we'll hear a bit of that next week.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it might be Thangam Debonair. Maybe.
I don't want to
say, but we will definitely recognise her voice when you put that up on the internet. I think this is really important, though, that an MP that stands before an election on one position, then once they become an MP, they start to be given a ministerial responsibility, and then they suddenly change their mind.
Yeah.
They lose all their conscience. They lose their interest in human rights. They change their views. This, is, of course, a form of fraud. So they're standing there on one platform, and then when they get into that authority, they're taking a different point of view.
That's why we are thinking this time we need to pay them back, because this is not the pain we will sleep with it. We will remember this in upcoming election.
I think it's important that their own words condemn them. You know, this is quite important. This is because part of the integrity of being an MP.
And to be honest, I was part of one of the political party in Bristol for last 22 years. I was one of the main campaigner and hold different position. But in next election, we will make sure we will bring the MP, or we will support the MP who will listen us, and he will not change his mind after winning the seat with our vote and with our support.
Okay, well, we're going to have a listen now to one of the main protagonists in all of this. That is a guy called Benjamin Netanyahu. Important to give the voices to the other side, even though these are the people who are calling for this genocide and excusing it. So here he is, long-time Prime Minister, also wanted on three charges of fraud over in Israel, which he's managed to dodge by changing the law about the way the Supreme Court operates over there. And there have been protests against him ever since the beginning of 2023 and all the way through this Gaza genocide for the last 5 weeks or so out on the streets, because they think he's running this war in a terrible way. And also many Jews who had a dream of some sort of paradise for them in the Holy Land are now finding that it's all turning to a nightmare. So let's have a listen to what Benjamin Netanyahu had to say this week about the hostages. And also,
Netanyahu.
Well, that's what Erdogan said, yeah. That Netanyahu on the hostages and a potential ceasefire.
How close are you to bringing some of the hostages home?
Well, we're closer than we were before we began the ground action, because the ground action has put pressure on Hamas to achieve a ceasefire. We'll have a temporary ceasefire if we can get our hostages back. I don't think it serves that purpose for me to elaborate further on that. We're doing every effort. It's part of our, our three war goals. One, to destroy Hamas. Second, to bring back our hostages to Israel. And third, to ensure that that threat, that terrorist threat, never arises again from Gaza, and that Gaza has a different future, better for us, for the Palestinians, and for the entire Middle East. So bringing back the hostages is an integral part of our war goals, and we're doing everything we can to achieve it.
But to be clear, are you considering a limited ceasefire?
I said that we would have a temporary ceasefire only if we have our hostages back, and I haven't changed what I said.
And would Israel agree to release Palestinian prisoners in exchange for hostages?
Nora, I don't think it helps. You can ask me, and that's your job. You're a journalist, and you should inquire. But I think there are certain things that we're holding as confidential until we have something to tell. And when we do, if we do, you and the entire world would know about it, including the hostage families.
This is the first chance to hear from you since the targeted raid on Al-Shifa Hospital. If Hamas is using a hospital as a command center, that is a war crime. Do you have concrete evidence?
Of course. First of all, we had concrete evidence that there were terrorist chieftains and terrorists, their terrorist minions, in the hospital. And in fact, they fled. As our forces approached, they fled. That's why we had no firefight. We entered that hospital with Arabic-speaking Israeli doctors, with incubators, and we had no firefight. But Hamas was using the patients in that hospital as a human shield. And on level minus two, we found a command and control center, military communications, coded equipment. We found bombs. We found weapons. And we also found terror tunnels in the hospital compound. Now, we're doing this very gingerly because we're trying to do the moral thing, the right thing, to deprive Hamas of having this safe zone in a hospital, but at the same time to neutralize its use as a command center for terrorists. And so far we've achieved it. I'm glad to say that we've been able to do that. We talked to the hospital administration. We told them we're coming in. Make sure that no one is there, no one is hurt. And so far we've achieved that. And I hope we'll continue to achieve that as we finish the job.
Where are the hostages being held? Do you know?
We had strong indications that they were held in the Shifa Hospital, which is one of the reasons we entered the hospital. If they were, they were taken out. We have intelligence about the hostages. But again, as to your first question, I think the less I say about it, the better.
Mr. Prime Minister, you've noted that one goal of the war is to de-radicalize Gaza. But does the violence and the killing of thousands of innocent civilians fuel a future generation of hatred?
First of all, any civilian death is a tragedy. And we shouldn't have any, because we're doing everything we can to get the civilians out of harm's way, while Hamas is doing everything to keep them in harm's way. So we send leaflets, we call them. We call them on their cell phones, and we say, leave. And many have left, but Hamas tried to stop them at gunpoint and fired at the safe corridors that we provided for the Palestinians. So they don't give a hoot about the Palestinians. They think they're safe in the underground, this messianic, theological, mad cult that is fighting below. And they're saying that, you know, damn the Palestinians above. We don't say that. We do everything we can to have them leave. That's what we're doing. The other thing that I can say is that we'll try to finish that job with minimal civilian casualties. That's what we're trying to do. Minimal civilian casualties. But unfortunately, we're not successful.
Unfortunately, we're not successful. So Nick Georges, you're still on the line joining us. I don't really want to go into the facts of whether or not the Al-Shifa Hospital was indeed a terrorist Hamas base and they ran away just before the Israelis came, and whether or not it really is a command and control center with bombs and tunnels. What exactly, I mean, I know you're from a group called Palestine Action. I'm interested in what actual action is taking place. You talked about peaceful protests outside the Elbit arms factories, but what else?
Well, I think since I came back from being a humanitarian witness in Palestine for two or three years, I spent two or three years writing to my MP, doing peaceful protests, going on peaceful marches, writing letters, giving talks to all sorts of groups about what I'd witnessed, none of which made any difference. People have been doing this since Israel invaded Palestine in 1948. People have been doing protesting, walking, everything else. And look where it's got us. The situation is now worse than ever before. The Palestinians have had more Palestinians killed, lost more land now than at any time ever in the history of the illegal Israeli invasion of Palestine. So none of these things we're doing are working. So in Palestine Action, we see these nine Elbit factories in England producing weapons that are sent to Israel to kill Palestinians. So we've realised now that it's no good asking governments to stop it. Governments issue all the export licences for all these horrendous weapons. They fudge them, they cheat them. So it's no good asking government. So what we do, it's no good going to government asking them to dig a well. What we do, we go out there and we dig the well ourselves and tell the government to stop us. So what we're doing, we're trying to shut down these nine arms factories in this country and stop them producing these horrendous weapons that are causing such massive destruction of life and property to the Palestinians. So that is our objective, to try and shut them down. And we do that in various ways. We try and occupy their roofs. When we occupy their roofs, we damage their roofs, cause as much damage as we can to shut the factories down as long as we can. Every day that we can shut one of those factories down is hopefully another day of life that some Palestinians in Gaza have. And yes, we're damaging those factories, but it's not a drop in the ocean compared to damage and the death and destruction that comes out of those factories. One of their factories in Oldham, we occupied the roof so many times, locked on outside the factory, and had so many mass protests outside. The local population in Oldham, once they realised that what was going on their doorstep, their children were walking past this arms factory day in, day out on their way to school, that was sending these horrendous weapons out to kill the Palestinians, they all came out in mass protest as well. And in the end, we forced that Elbit factory in Oldham to shut down and move. So it does work, and it's what we call direct action. And you don't ask the government to do it. It's a waste of time. We actually get stuck in ourselves and go to the source. And that's what we're trying to do, and especially in the horror of what's going on in Gaza now, and the arms trade, the money British government is making selling these weapons to Israel and dealing with them.
Well, I mean, just another aspect to all this. Sorry, Nick.
Sorry, another of the byproducts of what we do, every time we break into one of these factories, we shut them down, we breach their security, it gives them a huge problem with the MOD, who they've got millions of pounds worth of contracts with the MOD. And as a result of their security being breached by us, they have lost millions of pounds worth of contracts with the MOD because their security is being breached. So we are having an effect. It may be a drop in the ocean, and the arms companies are incredibly wealthy and incredibly powerful, but we are definitely causing them a problem. So much so that I think it was a year or two ago, Benny Gantz, who's the Israeli defense minister, was actually sent to England by Netanyahu to complain bitterly about Palestine Action's actions and what we were doing against their factories. So we're definitely upsetting them, and we are making a difference. And since then, the government has changed so many of the laws and rules on protests, mainly in an attempt to crush us as a result of pressure from Israel. We did a freedom of information request the other day, and we discovered that obviously a lot of our activists are taken to court, we're arrested by the police, we're taken to court, and we possibly risk prison sentences. Many of us have been imprisoned already. And we've discovered that the Israeli embassy is interfering directly with the director of public prosecutions in our court cases, which is outrageous.
Well, hang on. That sounds like someone like Keir Starmer. maybe. Yeah. Anyway, Nick, look, I'd just like to ask you, before we hear the view of Martin and Bushrat and the lady from Ofcom, about this idea of using the term terrorist to describe Hamas, because they have actually been proscribed, haven't they? In fact, many of these groups, which you would think actually are legitimate groups from a country which Britain considers hostile, but actually they are a legitimate group in that country, even though Britain doesn't like that country. It's not really fair, is it, Nick, to call Hamas terrorists? Because actually the Israeli army, the Israeli Defence Force, are far more powerful terrorists, delivering far more powerful terror.
Yes, well, I quite agree with you. When you look at the terror that Israel, the Israeli armies, the settlers, Air Force, Navy and everyone else has been committing upon the Palestinians, Hamas's terror is just pulls into complete insignificance. It's interesting. I think it was about 200 years ago in the deep south of America, the black slaves had a revolt and they killed about 200 white people. At the time, there was a very strong Christian movement in the south and they refused to condemn the black slaves. And they said it's a hypocrisy to condemn them, because when you look at how the white people have treated the black slaves over hundreds of years, killed them, abused them, and all the horrors that have been done to the black slavers and everything, you know, they said it's pure hypocrisy. Just because some of them get out and do something that's, yes, not very pretty, they said it's so hypocritical to criticise them.
I mean, there's something
because
a little
if
bit...
You do that to people, You have to expect to come back. If you treat people like that, you have to expect to come back, especially if you do it in their own country, on their own land that you have stolen from them.
Martin, this term terrorist, a bit Orwellian, isn't it? The idea that we're expected to see the Hamas as terrorists and the Israeli state as a democracy.
Well, there's an old Irish joke that goes, how do you know which ones are the terrorists? They're the ones with the little bombs. Okay. So if you've got little bombs and you've got small arms, you're a terrorist.
I suppose this is from the Irish Troubles, because, of course, the British Army were very much involved in supporting the loyalist terrorism and that sort of thing back in Northern Ireland.
I mean, it's just a general yeah. comment. Terrorists are the people that you don't like. When your army does nasty things, I mean, the SAS looks as if they've killed loads of innocent civilians in Afghanistan. Is that terrorism? No, because they're a regular army, and it's not terrorism, it's just army
Actually,
action.
Yeah, of course it is, and it's also a war crime. Bushrat, what do you make of this, using the term terrorism to describe Hamas? Actually, it's an elected organisation, and it's just that apparently the British and the Israelis and the United States just don't like Palestine.
Yeah, before I answer this word of terrorism, we are using from last many decades by our own choice. We bring the meanings when we want, whatever we want. I will give you example. When the war was happened against Soviet Union, all the Afghani people who was fighting against Soviet Union, these Americans called them heroes. These British called them heroes. There was a local hero for that time, and they was promoted. They were
they're freedom fighters.
Yeah, they were freedom fighter, and let's call they was jihadi, and they was a hero. I am witness myself. I'm 47. I witnessed that time. There was in a good book in America, and after 9/11, these same people, same faces, same situation. They become a terrorist.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go a little back, about few months back, when the people from Ukraine, they was fighting against the Russia, they was hero, because they are defending their houses, their property and their land against the Russia. The same thing, when situation is the same, when people from the Palestine, they are fighting for their land, they are fighting for their rights, they are fighting for humanity, we call them a terrorist. I believe this is the biggest hypocrisy we can ever witness.
It's something by the media, really, isn't it? The mass media misusing this word.
And who is using the media?
Not the BBC is one of the only things I'd like to just point out, because this week on the Peston Show, I've started becoming a bit of a Peston Show, addict, not that bad, but they do seem to have some really interesting guests on, and one of the guests this week was there. I think she was brought in specially. Her name is Melanie Dawes, Dame Melanie Dawes, sorry. Yeah. to talk about, she's from the chief executive of Ofcom, and she was brought in there because ITV's news' policy is to call Hamas terrorists. The BBC is not. And so she's brought in there really to haul her over the coals, saying, why is it that the BBC are allowed not to call Hamas terrorists?
Welcome back. I'm delighted to be joined by the head of Ofcom, top TV and media regulator. I suppose I better watch my step with you. delighted to see you, Melanie. A number of things about regulation puzzle lots of people. Now, you'll have seen the anger at the BBC, the controversy over the fact that it wouldn't refer to Hamas as a terrorist organisation. On ITV, since the beginning, we have referred to them as a terrorist organisation. Is this an impartiality issue? The BBC says it is. So why can two broadcasters take a completely different position on an issue like that?
Well, it's a good question, and it's good to be able to explain this on the show, actually. I mean, in the end, what Ofcom doesn't do is get involved in decisions on particular language, particular wording. We're the regulator, and we're here to make sure that overall programmes have got the right impartiality, particularly at a time like this. Mm-hmm. And that's about making sure that there's the right, you know, the right range of views and opinions brought to bear, but not particular language. And I think if we did get into that,
Even when you see, because obviously within the Jewish community, there's been a lot of upset with the BBC. Even when you see that degree of upset, you don't get involved.
So what we have done is speak to the BBC, and I've spoken to Tim Davey myself, to make sure that they are processing their complaints really quickly at a time like this. Mm. And, you know, when things go wrong, and some mistakes have been made by the BBC and others actually as well, I think it's also very important that the broadcasters say and admit that something went wrong and are really transparent about that. The BBC has published quite a lot about how they're approaching this, and I think that's a good thing, but they also need to, you know, as do all broadcasters, be really careful at a time like this to, you know, make sure that they attribute where facts are coming from and so on.
Martin, what do you make of this? This use of this term terrorism. She's hedging around, but of course, the fact is that Ofcom do care about language use. They've used the language that's been on channels like Press TV, the Iranian channel, and RT to literally ban that channel from being broadcast in Britain. So she's really talking out of her, well, how can I politely say, out of her armpit?
Well, I mean, Ofcom regulates broadcast media, and it doesn't, of course, have any remit really to regulate things like printed media. So you can see absolutely
they're taking an increasing role on the internet.
And of course, the internet, that's another grey area about whether they have the rat power to control that. And if you look, I mean, the 40 beheaded babies was all over the front pages of the paper press. And of course, they've had to admit later on that they didn't. There was no evidence for it, etc. But of course, the Ofcom doesn't really deal with that. It only deals really with broadcast media, like when we were on community radio. That was dealt with by Ofcom. This show is not.
That's right. It was a complaint that we were anti-Semitic, even though this program had been airing every week for about 3 or 4 months. A different member of the Israeli cabinet, which you never hear on British media. We were hearing for their views. And actually, I think it's a very important thing to do, because quite often the views of these Israeli cabinet members nowadays particularly are increasingly unhinged. So why can't we be hearing them?
Well, that's right. I mean, our little radio show, the UK Lawyers for Israel, who work very closely with the Israeli embassy, tried to close down our show and Bristol Community Radio. Wow. And it went to Ofcom, and we were able to argue, as Tony's just said, that we would be giving absolutely fair.
We're giving far more airtime to the Israeli view than most programmes.
What we were doing was every week we had a feature which was get to know the Israeli cabinet, and we had speeches by Israeli politicians, which we then criticised. And of course, Tony had contacted all of these politicians and said, "Do you want to speak?" They said no. So we then took stuff off the internet and used that.
Let's just be quite clear. I didn't actually contact the Israeli cabinet or the Israeli press office in London or anything like that. I just pinched their stuff from other channels like CNN, etc. They're speaking in English. Anyway, let's bushwrap. Yeah.
Can I add one thing? I appreciate you are doing amazing work for community, but unfortunately we are living in a control century. We are living in a prisons. We are occupied by the different big company. I will give you example. In last 7 years, my Facebook page closed more than 10 times. Whenever I raise a voice for Palestine, Kashmir, or even Myanmar, what they done? They straightway, I cannot appeal, I cannot have a right. They switch off my Facebook. My Facebook, the original Facebook, which shut down first time, it was 1.2 million followers. And just is closed because I was promoting Palestine protest. Then this become a habit. And then they switch off my Instagram page. They switch my Twitter account. And there is no any court. There is no any right of appeal. There is no any democratic way to approach them or appeal against them. So then I was banned from the Facebook, like a ex-president of America, David, I forget his name.
Yeah.
So him. I was blocked from Twitter for more than a year and a half. Then I changed my spelling and changed my name and done a different tact. And I'm on a Facebook and I'm a Twitter. But right now, I'm still under threat. If I promote Palestine protest or if I speak the truth, they will block me again. They do not want to listen.
Yeah.
So we call them terrorists, and they call. They want us a slave for their wishes. They want us what we want. They want to us to say what they want to. We have to say. They are controlling us.
Yeah, well, they're trying to anyway. I don't know if they're going to manage it or not. I doubt it very much, actually. So what they do is they kind of coerce and cajole. That's their general method. This is like the nudge unit or something. But anyway, another very interesting bit of news this week is a certain new arrival at the Foreign Office.
I know it's not usual for a Prime Minister to come back in this way, but I believe in public service. The Prime Minister asked me to do this job, and it's a time where we have some daunting challenges as a country. The conflict in the Middle East, the war in Ukraine, and of course, I hope that 6 years as Prime Minister, 11 years leading the Conservative Party, gives me some useful experience and contacts and relationships and knowledge that I can help the Prime Minister to make sure we build our alliances, we build partnerships with our friends, we deter our enemies, and we keep our country strong. That's why I'm doing the job, and I'm delighted to accept.
You have expressed publicly recently disagreements with the Prime Minister. Have you promised to button it? Is it a collective responsibility from here on in?
On the whole, as an ex-Prime Minister, I've tried to keep quiet about politics, stay out of politics. It's hard enough being Prime Minister without having your predecessors endlessly giving a running commentary. But look, of course, I've disagreed with some individual decisions, but politics is a team enterprise. I've decided to join this team because I believe Rishi Sunak is a good Prime Minister doing a difficult job at a hard time. I want to support him. I'm a member of the team and I accept the Cabinet collective responsibility that comes with that.
Let's explore what you've been doing since you were Prime Minister. The Treasury Select Committee accused you of a significant lack of judgment over your lobbying of ministers on behalf of the finance company Greensill. Why should voters trust your judgment now?
Well, the most important thing I've done since leaving office was to act as president of Alzheimer's Research and to raise millions of pounds and help our scientists to get closer to a diagnosis and a cure for something that affects almost 1 million people in our country. But today I resign from all of those things, from all of the businesses I've been helping and all the other things I've been doing, including being a professor at NYU, that all stops. I now have one job as Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, and I'm very proud to work with our Prime Minister to try and make sure our country can be as secure and as prosperous as possible.
I noticed you ducked my question on Greensill there. A specific answer to that question, the Treasury Select Committee branding a significant lack of judgment.
Well, I think all those things were dealt with by the Treasury Select Committee, by other inquiries at the time. And as far as I'm concerned, that is all dealt with and in the past. And I now have one job as Britain's Foreign Secretary, as part of Rishi Sunak's team, to try and make sure this country can be as secure and as prosperous in a difficult and dangerous world.
You're going to be Foreign Secretary in the House of Lords. It's not unprecedented, but it is unconventional. What do you say to the Speaker of the House of Commons, who has articulated a concern this afternoon about how you can be held to account when you can't appear in the House of Commons and face questions directly from MPs in there?
Well, I will be held to account in the House of Lords, where I have to account to for myself and for the government, and of course Andrew Mitchell and a very talented team of ministers at the Foreign Office will be held to account in the House of Commons. I'll obviously appear in front of the House of Commons select committees as appropriate to answer the questions. And of course, this government, my role in it, all of that will be accountable to the electorate at the general election when it comes. But in the meantime, I want to do everything to strengthen our alliances, to work with our friends, to build those vital partnerships, to make sure our country is secure and prosperous in a difficult and dangerous world. That work starts now, and I've got to get on with it.
Yes, very busy. He's got to shuffle away from Chris Mason's interview. It sounded like he was being interviewed in a bathroom there. I don't know if that was a sign of things to come with the professionalism at the Foreign Office media. Anyway, look, Nick, before you go, I just thought if you could, I'm glad you managed to hang on. But could you just give us your view on this extraordinary development? Because on Sunday we had Remembrance Sunday with the King and Rishi Sunak and David Cameron all stood there by the cenotaph. They all marched off into the Foreign Office, and we hear the next day that Cameron is Foreign Secretary.
Well, I remember a long time ago, Cameron was possibly the first Prime Minister to ever say that Gaza was an absolute open-air prison, which quite surprised me. And I was very pleased to hear him actually admit to that. But listen,
we'll have to see if we can
now.
Have to see if we can dig that clip out, actually. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, yeah. But hearing him now, you know, his obviously main concern is with security, building up alliances and friendships, presumably with Israel, and completely towing the party line. So I don't suspect there'll be much difference. I'm hoping there'll be a big difference between him and Suella Braverman and the rest of them. But I don't think at the end of the day, because of the controls in that government and in that party, he'll be allowed to be any different to any of his predecessors, which is
it would seem to me he's been recruited just because he will do exactly what he's told by the war machine, as he did in Libya and Syria. But anyway, look, Palestine Action, a fascinating organisation. You're definitely not a terrorist organisation. You are an anti-terrorist organisation. And so I wonder if you could, in fact, you're trying to stop genocide, which is a laudable thing. You know, I'd encourage all of our listeners to have a good look at you, and if they've got the time and the wherewithal to support you in some way. Whereabouts is the where can we follow Palestine Action and your work, Nick, online? I guess that's the only way nowadays. It's not like it's like a little phone number or something.
Yes, yeah. Well, we do tweet. You can find us on Twitter. We're also on Instagram. And what I'll do, I haven't got it with me now, but I think I'll find you the email address where if they really want to join, they want to get involved, they can talk to us. And we've got our own website, Palestine Action website. And if they want to join us or they're interested or they want to help us financially, subscribe to us, that would be really appreciated, because we do need all the help we can get. It's a really difficult job we're trying to do. And you know, we risk prison in trying to do what we do. And, you know, if people are interested, we run workshops so we can tell them what's involved. There's many ways that people can help, apart from climbing on roofs.
But yeah, I mean, it's amazing stuff you're doing. I think it's also very important because we're a talking shop here. We don't actually do anything. You guys do something, as the Jordanians have been doing this week. I was amazed to hear, in getting volunteer transport aircraft pilots to fly over Gaza, dropping medical supplies, food and water into Gaza, so daring the Israelis to shoot them down. So these are the sorts of actions which can relieve, and I think in a way it's about the morale of the poor Gazan people who are just being slaughtered and looking out there wondering what on earth is the world doing to help us. Well, you're certainly doing something. I would say we're not really by just talking about it. You're taking action, and so are the Jordanians. Nick Georges, thanks very much for joining us.
No, you're more than welcome. Thank you very much for giving us airtime and helping us hopefully move further down the line and be more effective in trying to shut these horrific Israeli arms companies down. So thank you for your support in that, Tony.
Bless you. And any days in court All the best with that too. Bushra, I'll also ask you about Cameron. What do you make of this ex-Prime Minister? He's suddenly been made a peer. I was watching King Charles. I was watching Rishi Sunak on Sunday at the Remembrance Service in Whitehall. I was watching David Cameron all walking into the Foreign Office. And it's almost as if the King Charles said to Rishi Sunak, can we have this guy as Foreign Minister? I like him.
To be honest, I have a very clear stand about that. They are all bunch of failures. We test them. We try them. They always been failed to run our country. And we know who diplomat they are or hypocrite they are. As you said in a few seconds ago, that he was the first prime minister who said that Gaza is a open prison. No, if we can ask him the same question, if you ask him the same question, what do you think he will reply? He will not stand for his own wording.
He might well be a little bit like Thangham, or sorry, or whoever the MP was. He was changing her mind when she stood. Anyway, let's have a listen to one of Cameron's speeches when he was Prime Minister.
Prime Minister Jibril has confirmed that Colonel Gaddafi is dead. I think today is a day to remember all of Colonel Gaddafi's victims, from those who died in connection with the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie to Yvonne Fletcher in a London street, and obviously all the victims of IRA terrorism who died through their use of Libyan Semtex. We should also remember the many, many Libyans who died at the hands of this brutal dictator and his regime. People in Libya today have an even greater chance after this news of building themselves a strong and democratic future. I'm proud of the role that Britain has played in helping them to bring that about, and I pay tribute to the bravery of the Libyans who've helped to liberate their country. We will help them, we will work with them, and that is what I want to say today. Thank you. Can I say what an honour it is to be here in Tripoli with you to see how the Libyan people are taking their country back and taking it forward to a new era. A few weeks ago, Gaddafi was still in control here in Tripoli, and I think what the world has seen is frankly an impressive transformation. Your roads are full again of traffic, your water is flowing, your hospitals are working. This is impressive. And I'm proud of the role that Britain played in helping you to do this. And I'm even more proud, having seen what I've seen today, of the impressive changes you are making. But this was your revolution, not our revolution. It was those brave people in Misrata, in Benghazi, in Brega, in Zlitan, in Tripoli, in the Nafusa Mountains, who were incredibly brave in removing the dreadful dictatorship of Gaddafi. And I pay tribute to those people throughout Libya today. It is your revolution, it is their bravery that has enabled this to happen. As Nicola has said, we want to help you diplomatically, militarily, economically, and with your development. We are your friends, but this is your country, your leadership, your plan. We stand ready to help, but we want to know what it is you most want us to do. This does go beyond Libya. This is a moment when the Arab Spring could become an Arab summer, and we see democracy advance in other countries too. And I believe you have the opportunity to give an example to others about what taking back your country can mean.
Well, that's our new Foreign Secretary, David Cameron. I suppose he's Lord Cameron now. The actual reality in Libya on the day this week, though, is a real hell. The climate refugees of Libya's floods and regional strife. Really a brilliant article from Al Jazeera saying just what an absolute basket case Libya has turned into, being run by international crime gangs, arms gangs, and not even having a one single government. many people being displaced, horrific floods recently destroying one of their towns because there's no maintenance being done on any of the infrastructure. Actually, what Gaddafi was doing, he was building up the infrastructure. He turned the country into the place in Africa which had the lowest infant mortality rate, the highest standard of living in the entire continent of Africa. Now it's been bombed back effectively to the Stone Age, Martin. But this whole Libya business with Gaddafi and David Cameron was very much responsible for this.
Well, that's right. And of course, it wasn't just a spontaneous uprising. Operation Southern Mistral 2012 had both the French and British air forces having an exercise of intervening in an Arab country on the other side of the Mediterranean, unnamed, where there was an uprising and the government attempted to use aircraft to attack demonstrators who were peacefully demonstrating. Now, there was, in fact, a British parliamentary inquiry into that claim, and it was rubbish. As the Russians said at the time, we've got satellites. Gaddafi is not using planes to attack demonstrators. So the excuse for the intervention was absolutely wrong. And, of course, what Cameron doesn't mention there is the intimate relationship going back to the 1980s between the British security services and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, many of whose members were trained by our special forces and infiltrated into Afghanistan in the 1980s, as was mentioned by Bushrat here. And, of course, the other thing that they did, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, they blew up the Manchester Arena, because they're based, their base outside Libya is in Manchester as a result of the fact that, that they basically worked with MI6 for years and years and years and years and years. Now, in other words, Cameron is part of the deep state establishment, which is why he's been brought in to be foreign secretary at this moment. And of course, don't think you're going to get any difference from David Lammy if he becomes foreign secretary after the next election. They're all bought and paid for. The person who isn't bought and paid for, who was foreign secretary, is Robin Cook, and he's dead. And he's not foreign secretary anymore, is he?
Well, I think he was almost certainly assassinated.
That's what I suspect as well, Tony.
Just before we hear from Bushrat, I'd like to hear another little clip from David Cameron and another one of his foreign policy exploits that King Charles seems to think is a wonderful thing. I mean, Rishi Sunak, I don't know. He seems to me just to be a cipher that does what he's told.
I don't think any regime that carries out acts as they have against their own citizens, and continue to do so, by the way, should survive. I think that regime should go. So the message to President Assad is it is time for transition, it is time for you to go. The message to President Putin, who I discussed this with at the G8 in Mexico, and the message to all those on the UN Security Council, it is time for the UN Security Council to pass clear and tough messages about sanctions, I believe under Chapter 7 of the UN, and to be unambiguous in this. Now, obviously, we are a UN Security Council with permanent members, and permanent members that have vetoes. We can't pass these things without everybody stepping up to the plate and taking the right action. But I would appeal to those who in the past have held out against tough action against Syria, that, you know, what more evidence do we need about a regime that has brutalized its own people? And as I say, the alternative to political transition at the top of Syria is revolution from the bottom in Syria. And I think it is in everybody's interest, the Syrian people, the region, the wider world, the fight against terrorism. It is in everybody's interest that that transition takes place, and that political transition takes place quickly. The sooner that happens, the sooner the people of Syria can be freed from the tyranny under which they're currently suffering.
Top-notch professional liar. But old Assad is not there, is he, anymore? That's what Cameron wanted. But, Assad did manage to stay there a bit because the Russians helped him out a bit. But anyway, what do you make of this whole... Because that was a transition, wasn't it? The Libyan so-called civil war, which was a proxy war by NATO and the West. Particularly Cameron was a leading figure in all that. And then many of these fighters, the mercenaries that had been employed in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi, then moved to Syria, didn't they?
Well, Abdul Hakim Balhaj was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and then he was taken by the British to Syria to organise terrorists, let's call them terrorists, inside Syria. Are we allowed to use these words? Anyway, that's certainly how the Syrian government regarded them. And, of course, Assad had an election in 2014, which he won. because the Russians insisted on it. But of course it was ignored in the West, and of course we've not had any serious elections in Libya since the overthrow of Gaddafi. And the Cameron has got form for smashing Middle Eastern states. And when he's talking there, if there's no change from the top, there'll have to be revolution from below. Well, tell that to Hamas. They believe in that as well. No change from the top, revolution from below. And of course, Hamas were aligned with those who were trying to overthrow Assad, which caused some problems for the Syrian government and the Syrian army. So Hamas were in the game of getting rid of Assad, but of course they've now changed their mind as they realise who their real friends are. The West has been intervening in these countries for its own selfish purposes for many, many decades.
Okay, Bushrat, what do you make of this? This is one of the reasons, it seems to me, that Cameron has been brought in. And literally overnight, the day after Remembrance, which seems to be the day they don't remember anything, Sunday, the next day, suddenly this person who's been involved in effectively these overthrowings of foreign governments, many would call war crimes, that he's been involved in the Middle East, part of this wider US and Israeli plan to balkanize the Middle East, to overthrow Middle Eastern governments. Seven countries in 5 years, I think it was, yes. The US General Wesley Clark said. So he's an operator for the deep state, and he's now back again. And suddenly we can make him a lord and put him in charge, even though the people basically rejected him in the 2016 referendum.
Yes. Okay, before we speak about David Cameron, I want to mention about Gaddafi and under his leadership. We all witness under the Gaddafi leadership, his country in one of the top five richest country was in Africa, and which is basically 11,000 basic gross income was for individuals in Africa. Right now, they are less than $4,000, and they are under the Gaddafi leadership, they were one of the most richest GDP country with health, wealth, education, and free medicine.
You know what? They didn't have any debt with the IMF either,
yes,
not a penny.
Not a single penny. That was the only country under the Gaddafi leadership was the democratic, or let's call the free from IMF, World Bank, or any other loan organization. But right now, they are more than 3 million people are living below the life of the basic life. And there is no, they said they will bring the democratic situation back to the country. But right now there is no democratic. Their situation is more worse. They are like a civil war, and they have become quiet. No, let's talk about the David Cameron. I will call him a war criminal. And that kicked out by his own party and the public of the British government. When the failure is of recognized by his own party and the public, no, we are bringing him back to save the situation. What do you think what will be his stand for a situation? He will speak lie again, like all the ex-prime ministers speak with us about Iraq war, about Afghanistan war, diplomatic or an hypocritic status. So we are become used to for these hypocritics and these so-called leadership. I think this is the time, as a British citizen, we need to kick them out by the power of our vote, and we need to deny them, and we need to bring them on justice.
I think there's quite a lot in the Conservative Party that agree that they don't want to win the next general election. Yeah. So Cameron seems to be an ideal person to bring in, Martin. But we did an investigation into David Cameron, didn't we? Do you remember him around about the time that Nelson Mandela died? We did a report on him being involved in doing some very dodgy fundraising for the Conservative Party involving South African nuclear weapons.
Well, in the 90s, the South Africans agreed to give up their nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which the Israelis had helped them to develop. And the Israelis, of course, got their nuclear weapons by stealing components from the United States. And of course, it's completely illegal for them to have nuclear weapons. If in actual fact, if they admitted they had nuclear weapons, there's legal they would legally have to be put under sanctions.
Yeah, well, I've got a report of ours from 2013 when Mandela died, where we looked deeply into this. This is about 5 or 6 minutes, where it's quite obvious that David Cameron was involved in this very illegal nuclear arms deal. Basically, the South Africans had nuclear weapons. When it came to black majority rule, they decided that they didn't want the ANC in South Africa to have those nuclear weapons. They'd been developed jointly with the Israelis, and obviously apartheid being one of the key connections between those two countries at the time before the ANC took over. And so I thought it'd be interesting to have a little listen to that, because Cameron is really trying to make out that he was a big friend of Mandela, but actually he really was... he did this nuclear arms deal in secret behind Mandela's back.
One of the first people, if not the first person, to sign the book of condolence at the South African embassy in Trafalgar Square was David Cameron. But it's interesting to see that he had a freebie trip to apartheid South Africa right at the height of the ban, really. I mean, he admitted his party had got it wrong, though, over sanctions when he later visited Mandela. David Cameron accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to apartheid South Africa while Nelson Mandela was still in prison. An updated biography of the Tory leader reveals today a trip by Mr. Cameron in 1989, when he was a rising star of the Conservative Research Department, was a chance for him to see for himself, and was funded by a firm that lobbied against the imposition of sanctions on the apartheid regime. Critics described it as a sanction-busting jolly that raised questions about the character of the man who, after a week when the government's credibility on the economy hit a new low, this is back in April 2009, was on course to be Prime Minister in little more than a year's time.
Yeah, that trip in 1989 is quite interesting, because two other people were on that trip. One was Sir Kenneth Warren, who most people won't have heard of, but he's a rather important fundraiser for the Conservative Party and has been for many years, a sort of a money man. And the other third person on that trip was Dr. David Kelly. And the purpose of the trip was to go to arms
corps.
This
is the government scientist who died in 2003 in
the very same one. So there were three people on this delegation: Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren, and David Cameron, who is a 20-something from Conservative Central Office. And information that we've been receiving suggests that there was a deal being cooked up. South Africa had 9 nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which they developed at Pelindaba with the Israelis. One of them was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 nuclear weapons. It's like 10 green bottles, isn't it, this story? Anyway, as the changes were about to take place in South Africa, the Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, Arms Corps, which was the their equivalent of BAE Systems, and they basically went to the West via an intermediary called John Bradenkampf, who was an ex-Rhodesian SAS operative, but was now actually a major arms dealer. People can look him up on the internet, and they will find him. He actually lives in Kilmersdown in Somerset now. But basically, they did a deal. They said, we don't want Nelson Mandela and the ANC to have these 9 nuclear warheads. So
this is actually the white South African government saying that, well, since the country's going over to black majority rule, we think that they shouldn't have access to these secret nuclear weapons we've got.
Yeah, because otherwise Nelson Mandela would have got his finger on the nuclear button as soon as he won the election. That wasn't acceptable to the white South African elite, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers either. So they did a deal whereby these 9 nuclear warheads, which were uranium-based nuclear warheads, were sold to the Western powers. 6 to the Americans and 3 to the British. But what happened, the American warheads were loaded at Durban and taken to the US and dismantled. The 3 British warheads, and this is what the delegation, we suspect this delegation was about, they weren't sold to the British government directly. A private company called Astra Holdings, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember them, set up by a chap called Stephen Koch, who used to be an MI6 officer. They bought the 3 warheads, as it were, on the black market from Arms Corps, and then sold them on to the British government for £50 million. And Margaret Thatcher, one of the last things she did as she left office was sign a payment order for £50 million to Astra Holdings for these three warheads. But the warheads, of course, they had bought them from the South African government at much less than £50 million. And those who were involved in this scam got basically a profit from it, including the Conservative Party itself, which made £17.8 million to fund the 1992 general election.
Now, that's a pretty shocking accusation, Martin. Also, well, I've made it before. Find it, you know. People can find it online. It's an article by Peter Eyre. It's probably the best one to find. You can find EYRE on his own blog or on the Palestine Telegraph website about this whole story. But what evidence have you got for it?
Well, I'm getting evidence from people who were involved. So they're talking to me. I can't say who because they've signed the Official Secrets Act. But in any case, as you say, if people want to check this story for themselves, they can find it on Palestine Telegraph or Peter Ayres.
I mean, this 17 million donation, for example, is there any evidence for that?
Yes, there is. Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, had been tipped off about this, and he made a question in the House of Commons. I can't remember what the year was. It was in the 1990s. Say, well, where did this £17.8 million come from? And there was a sort of bluff, we can't possibly tell you, you'll have to look into it. But anyway, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, even in banker terms, £17.8 million is not peanuts, and in political terms, it's quite a large amount of money.
Yeah, certainly.
Possibly could have made the difference between major losing or winning the election, for example.
Well, certainly a fascinating twist to David Cameron's trip.
There's a further twist to the story, of course, which is that the warheads themselves then went missing. They lost them.
Well, how did they get the money for this £17 million then?
They went round Tory party donors and asked them to chip in to the pot, and then all of these people would then be paid back, and they were paid back. We've been given a list of people who actually made a lot of money out of this.
Well, quite a fascinating tale. Fascinating tale there. And Martin, it does really imply that there is a very much a kind of deep state role that Cameron is prepared to take on. In fact, if he's prepared to be a nuclear arms dealer and to steal nuclear weapons and to pass them off and then lose them, the guy is really, I mean, he's going to do everything he's told. It's almost the most amazingly blackmailable episode in history, where people can threaten him that, well, if you don't do as you're told, this is going to be on the front page of the Daily Mail tomorrow.
Well, that's right. And I think about who he is. He went to Eton College, and the person who was giving me all this information was saying, well, that school for scandal, Eton College, you can imagine what it's like. School for Scoundrels, Eton College. But of course, what it is that...
George Orwell went there.
Yes,
it's a jolly good place.
Yes, I know, but the point is, they are basically joining what's like a gang, like in The Ends, yeah? They're joining a gang, and they're teenagers, and they learn that this is what people like us do, yeah? We're involved in all of this kind of, essentially, criminal business, because this whole episode was criminal. They got the warheads. They took them to Dubai, and then the people that were selling them the warheads, Bredenkamp, I can name him, who was an arms dealer from Rhodesia. They then turned round to the British Tories that they'd sold the weapons to, the warheads to, and of course the Tory party itself got 17 million. Other people got payoffs because they'd chipped in to the scam. And they said to them, "What warheads? What are you going to do? Call the police? This is a criminal enterprise. You've been involved in it. We're not giving you the warheads."
Well, that's
and the warheads then disappeared. Nobody knows where they went, but they could easily have ended up in places like North Korea, for example. But nobody, this is all because
they could possibly have landed up in Ukraine.
Well, indeed, they could. They could be anywhere.
And this is why maybe the Russians were a little bit annoyed about.
Well, exactly. But the point about this is that Cameron is from this elite group that think they run this country, and they do run this country. Yeah? Jacob Rees-Mogg knows an awful lot more about this particular scam than he would like to talk about.
Why'd you say that?
Because where this all was organised from was Bredenkamp in Little Rhodesia, which is in the Mendips, all of the Rhodesians who've fled from the black majority rule in Zimbabwe, they ended up living in the Mendips. And that's where Braden and Camp was based.
I haven't read anything about this in the Mendip Courier. But anyway, so Bushirat, before you go, can you just give us your take on, you know, whereabouts this whole conflict is heading? Because I think many of us are concerned that the arrival of David Cameron makes it even less likely that there's going to be some sort of humanitarian decision come from Britain over to the or even any kind of pressure at all being put on the Israelis to start calming down and to stop killing innocent people.
I don't think so. David Cameron will bring any change in our government stand. He's just a puppet of the current government. And become he on the position, I think the situation will be get worse. And we have a long-standing history from last 50, 60 years after Second World War, especially after the 9/11. People killed by innocent. And these company, the big, these so-called democratic champion, they are just making money, power hunger. And same thing with the United Nations, the bench of idiots, nothing more than a social club or the side chick for America. I call United Nations what I feel. And the same thing is not only the U.S. or the United Kingdom, we also have the same feeling for OIC, which is called Organization of Islamic Country. They are doing nothing other than a statement. And the same thing, European Union and the rest of the world. So these are a shareholder equal in a terrorist. What happening in Israel? I demand day before yesterday, from the United Nations and other so-called champion, democratic champion country, why they not put a sanction on Israel the way they done in Iraq, the way they done in Iran, the way they done on Afghanistan? Why they are on a silent? Why always a double standard?
Well, look, you're a Bristolian, so we're not just going to talk about Palestine. We're also going to talk about Barton Hill, because we've been in the national news this week here in Bristol. And the latest news on the close down of this enormous tower block in Barton Hill is that the police have descended on Barton House today after city centre protests by residents there, or not residents. Some people have actually been having to sleep in their cars because they've got nowhere to go and the council hasn't provided them with anywhere to go. This is because on Tuesday this week, there was a sudden announcement that the people who lived in this big tower block in Barton Hill were going to have to leave. This is hundreds of families, and that the whole place was going to be mothballed, and they said for a few days. Now, I'm not sure if it really is going to be for a few days. It could maybe be for much, much longer than that. But anyway, residents today have arrived in Bristol city centre. They were gathering at College Green. Protesters at College Green outside the council house in solidarity with the 400 people that had been evacuated from Barton House. The protest was organised by Acorn Bristol and saw campaigners call for an independent inquiry. There are also two other big events happening in the city centre. Children descended on College Green for another school strike for Palestine and Red Maid School Founders Commemoration Day was also taking place. But this is quite extreme, isn't it, to tell hundreds of people just to leave their home. Now, this is a problem apparently which has been going on. I had a chat with Paul Smith, the former cabinet member for housing. He said this is a problem they've known about for many years.
50 years. I was there on a block to stand with people who get in victim, I call them a victim, by our city council failure, because the city council was aware the situation from the last many years, and they failed to organize the proper, respectful way eviction. But they announced suddenly and they asked people to empty their flats within 2 hours. And they get empty flat about 7 o'clock, and they did not get accommodation till 2 o'clock at night. So there was a shelterless, there was a homeless sitting in a car or sitting in a cafes on a road. If some are lucky, they get accommodation in a friend's house. And then later on, they give them accommodation. I am touch with them, everyone. Even that night, I offer my house for the people who was victim for that Button Hill blocks. And there was two families. They came to me about 3 o'clock at night asking accommodation. I provide them accommodation. And I send the email to the mayor and a local councillor as well. If anyone from any color or culture or religion, they want to come have a short-term accommodation, I will provide. But my question from the city council, when they was aware of the situation, why was they quiet? Why they did not come with a some major plan? There was new, the families are 95 families with the total number of 470 people, and there are more than 15 to 16 people, children are under 1 year old.
Okay, well, so, look, just before the this announcement, was, which was literally just as the full council was about to meet its monthly meeting of all the councillors in the city, there was actually a protest going on outside, a pro-Palestine protest.
Yeah, that's right. And we were supposed to give a public speech on a public gathering, and local two councillors, one from the Labour councillor Farah Hussain, and second, I forget name, sorry for my short memory. They were supposed to give us a motion and present in our council house. But I was touched with the both of them. There is no upcoming date announced so far. So
this was cancelled at the last minute. Now, the big embarrassment here is that the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, decided, well, there's two big embarrassments then. First of all, he decided when the attack on Israelis by Gaza, by Hamas took place, to actually project the colours of the Israeli flag right across the council house. Now, this hasn't really necessarily gone down very well, particularly because now what's happened is a mass genocide by the people he seems to be supporting, and he's not even in the country. So it does seem to me as if there was a certain degree of controlling of the agenda of this meeting, that they were worried that at this council house it was going to be very embarrassing for the mayor to have to try and defend this genocide that he's supporting.
To be honest, that was one of the worst movements. He done many mistakes, but this was one of the biggest mistakes done by the Marvin Rees. And we had a meeting with him, and we gave this press release as well with the other local colleague of mine. We was asking him, okay, as a Palestinian protester or Palestinian supporter, I always stand for the people who die in Israel. We feel sorry for them, and we have the same sympathy for the way the Palestinians are dying. Because my stand is very clear as a member of human rights organization and a chair of the international human rights movement. I'm working in more than 60 countries with 150,000 people. I represent humanity. I do not represent any color, culture, or religion. In my organization, all kind of people are standing with me for any cause. And that was my demand. Okay, whatever you done, we will not say you done wrong or right. Okay, you show your solidarity for people who die in Israel on the 7th of October. Where is your solidarity when more than 12,000 yeah. people die?
Martin, this is a very divisive thing, actually, to project that Israeli flag up on the city council for Marvin and the leadership of the Labour group and the city council in the mayor's office to have done, isn't it? It's actually very divisive. At the very least, that they should have both flags up there. But no, we're just going to have the colours of the Israeli flag.
Well, it was projected onto Downing Street as well, and it was done all over the country. Now, I don't want to go into this detail at the moment, Tony, but there are serious questions about what actually happened on October the 7th, which we have covered in previous weeks.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that now. I'm talking about the politics here in the city.
The policy is...
Because we've got, obviously, a lot of support for the Palestinians in Bristol, and it seems as if the mayor is completely in the... A bit like central government, is going off in the other direction. And not only that, he's sailed off to Rwanda. He's not even in the country. He's talking about climate change or something. He's not running the city.
Well, listen, he's not going to be there in May, as we all know.
Well, so can he just...
retire
yes,
now.
Well, well, I mean, he certainly, if he deserves to be criticised, we will criticise him. It's not just him that projected.
But it's not criticism, actually. With the Barton House, it's fury.
Are you still supporting
the party? Martin, the local people are furious with him.
Martin, let's ask before we ask Marvin, let's ask you, are you still supporting Labour Party?
I'm a member of the Labour Party.
No, if you're a member, you're paying.
I am a member of the Labour Party.
So you're paying?
Yes, I'm still paying for the member of Labour. But don't forget, 54 Labour MPs voted for a ceasefire.
And rest?
The rest didn't.
Your local MPs?
They didn't. I'm not happy.
Okay, so what do you stand for it?
Well, why do I stand? I'm not going to stand for it.
No. What do you stand?
Well, I think what's going to happen politically...
Will you resign from the Labour Party?
Just let him answer.
I think what's going to happen politically in Bristol West is clear. The Greens could take that seat. Fangham Debonair could not be the MP next May or next September, whenever they.
This is
next
your
October.
Prediction, or
it's a prediction. That's a prediction.
Okay, which party you will vote in next election?
It's a secret ballot for a reason.
Okay. Which party you will support?
I'm a member of the Labour Party, but it's a secret ballot, and I'll leave it there.
I'm asking your support.
I want to remain a member of the Labour Party.
Quite within his rights not to answer that question.
Yeah,
if
you understand
he wishes.
What I'm saying?
He can vote. Listen, he can vote for monster raving looting party if he wants, and he doesn't have to tell anybody.
No, if I say in a public forum like this who I'm going to vote for, I can be kicked out of the Labour Party.
Let's just talk about the people in the House, because they did a demonstration today at Bristol City Centre, and they were demonstrating outside the City Hall, only to hear that the council staff were inside Barton House removing their belongings.
By force. That's I was there in a protest, and I am a witness the whole they treat without any planning, and they do not have, you know, where they are right now, mostly people, they are in different hotels with a very worse situation, and they are only getting a breakfast. They do not have anything to arrange for a lunch. They are not getting any money, so they are getting...
They're having to go back into the house to cook. And for their children, for example.
So where is the safety for that time? Let's suppose if the building is not safe, why they are
To be honest, let's just look at this as an exercise in chaos. When somebody like Marvin Rees, the mayor, is about to face a very difficult time in a full council meeting, answering questions about support for genocide, with the people in the city that do not support that, obviously, and he's going to have to actually face those people face to face. It seems to me, even though he's over in Kigali, I don't know if he's going to be on Zoom or he has a representative at full council. Maybe he just jetted out that evening. But he doesn't want to face these people. He's decided to press a chaos button and talk about a load of nonsense to do with, this place is unsafe to live in, evacuate 100 families and put them to immense inconvenience just to sow chaos as a diversion away from the fact that he is supporting genocide by the Israelis.
I think that Marvin has already paid the price for doing these kind of silly statements. He was not elected as an MP candidate from the own Labour Party. So this was a very clear message for Marvin that you are doing something wrong. And one of the known Bristol Labour member came from all the way from London. He is a Bristol citizen, and he become the win the Labour Party ticket competition with the Marvin Rees, and this was a very big message to Marvin Rees that he need to fix himself and he need to check various things going on. And secondly, the Labour Party always gets support from the BME community and especially from the Muslim sector. 79% Muslim always vote Labour Party from last many decades. And this time right now, the situation is changed and people are thinking to change their situation, and people will remember and people will remain with this decision that all the Labour Party member in Bristol, all the Labour councillor in Bristol, they was failed to say any word for our Palestine, and they was failed to attend any protest. And they was failed to give any statement. Even we demand a local MP and local councillor and a mayor of Bristol at least ask for a ceasefire or show the solidarity for Palestine. At least attend the protest. Less if you do not want to speak as your party policy, but at least have to say something, at least come to join as a protester, but they said they want to deny this.
Okay, well, the arrival of David Cameron is in the background to all of this, of course, and a new... you say you don't think anything's going to change. Well, it might be that his experience in lying and starting foreign wars is actually going to change policy. Our poll from Monday, this is Yahoo News, from midday Monday until midday Thursday, asked, how do you feel about David Cameron's return to politics? It received nearly 45,000 votes and showed a clear majority of Yahoo readers reacted negatively. So it was either 61% said they were unhappy with his return, with only 30% saying they were happy. 9% did not go either way. So this is, Martin, there is twice as many people saying they don't want Cameron around as saying that they do. Then there was also another poll. How strongly do you feel about his return? 22,000 votes in that one. Indicating many readers were either very enthusiastic about the move or felt strongly it was in the wrong decision. The average strength of feeling score on all votes was 6.5 out of 10. An Ipsos poll found half of voters thought his appointment of foreign secretary was the wrong move, 35%. This isn't democracy, is it? This guy's been put in there because some elites want him in there. The people don't.
Well, I think that will show when it comes to the general election.
Isn't it interesting? Carrington was the last foreign secretary who was from the Lords. Now, he was a Bilderberg chairman, and he was the guy who was defence secretary when the troubles happened in Northern Ireland. So he was of a similar stripe, using these... I mean, you're talking about the Eton College, a school for scoundrels. You know, these are the sort of peoples that will create wars, they will create violence, and then they'll see if they can get away with it. They're the biggest chancers and liars in politics.
Well, they are, but it's not just them. I'm afraid Keir Starmer has made his position clear, and of course it's causing problems for the Labour Party because of what he's done. But don't think the Labour... I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is no longer a member of the Labour Party, so he isn't counted in the 50-odd Labour MPs who voted for ceasefire. He voted as an independent representing Islington North, as did Diane Abbott representing her constituency.
Well, it sounds to me like they're a very authoritarian party. Anyway, you're going to have to go now, Bushrat, but can you just tell us about the protest? You've got another one going on tomorrow, and how people can follow Bristol for Palestine.
Okay, it is very simple. They can follow on hashtag Bristol Digit 4 Palestine. Is hashtag Bristol for Palestine.
Why do you call it Palestine? It's Palestine, isn't it?
It's a pronunciation. We educate from Pakistan, so we have a different accent.
Okay, just a pronunciation. Okay, go for it.
Pronunciation. So right. That is what we are. And secondly, they can follow us on Facebook. They can engage us on our telephone number, which is 077-2002. I will repeat again if the people want to write down.
Well, that's not enough numbers.
Okay, it's 077-2002-1978. That is our WhatsApp number. You can engage with us. We will only approach you for a Palestine protest. We have a WhatsApp groups. And secondly, hashtag Bristol for Palestine. That's a simple. They can approach us on a Twitter, on Instagram or Facebook, and we will update you all the events coming in a Bristol, regardless which organization doing, who is doing and who is promoting. So we will engage all the protest and all the activities, what happening in a Bristol, you will find out through this link.
Well, there was a thanks very much for that, Bushrat Ali there. Number, and I'll repeat it at the end of the show, 077-2002-1978. And that's probably the easiest way on WhatsApp to get stuff. I mean, I'm hopeless on email. I don't know about you folks out there. But we're going to listen now to...
Just mention that there is a protest tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, tomorrow.
There's a protest tomorrow assembling at Castle Park at 12:30 to leave Castle Park at 1 o'clock. And this is where if people want to do something tomorrow, that's what's happening
so
in Bristol.
So this is a Bristol
tomorrow.
It's a Bristol hate march, is it?
Yes,
it is.
Yes, it's Suella Braverman would no doubt call it such, but
she
I don't
last
agree.
Long after saying that, did she? Nor about how living in tents is a lifestyle choice.
I want to comment on this. Why they only remove her? Even the Prime Minister of this country have the same stand, but he did not use the word hate protest, but he's standing with clearly with Israel about his donation, about his support, about his visit. He's a supporting the
terrorists. I like your mind, Bushrak. You think like I do. You're very suspicious minded. And looking at why is it? I think Suella Braverman was over the last few weeks. She was fed a whole load of stuff by special advisers, extreme stuff to say that would give Rishi Sunak a good excuse to sack her. So in other words, that then creates a little movement. That enables him to do a nice reshuffle and change a few things in his cabinet. So it seems almost deliberate to me the way that over the last few weeks she's been making these very extreme statements and that it's a perfect excuse to just boot her sideways. She's just been used and now we've got, as you say, we've got a new Home Secretary and David Cameron. And so this protest tomorrow here in Bristol is it's 12:30, Castle Park, with a march at 1:00. And of course, all lovely, peace-loving people. Do you want to just say something about, do you ever have arrests and things like that on your marches?
Okay, there is something. I was arrested. I was in a 17-hour in a prison. And they did not charge me so far. But that is...
So when was that?
On the 23rd of October, before my...
So what did they arrest you for?
That's something very... it's not something I want to mention right now, because it is something very...
Well, you haven't been charged, so we're quite happy we can talk about it quite freely.
Okay. It was from my local Muslim community. We have a so-called leadership and so-called self-promoter, and they was part of with me till they was knew they will get chance to speak as a speaker. They was knew that they will get chance to get some glory in a protest. They will get some photos for their Facebook status. But somehow, somewhere, due to the change of date, because initially we was planning to do the protest on the 22nd of October, and we changed to the 29th of October, and they was engaged somewhere else, and then they tried to force me to change the date, change the time, and their event was only for 50-60 people. I request them, you can change your date and time. They did not agree. They was doing some political reason. I request them, okay, you start your program 12 o'clock, finish 2 o'clock, and join us. If you don't want to finish 2 o'clock, join us at 4 o'clock in a college green. We will still give you chance to speak, and we will still give you chance to glory and hunt some fame. But due to their personal problem, they was unable to attend on the day. Then they start to use local Muslim community, especially head of local imams, to say this protest is against Islamic law, because the women and men will get mixed. So they get this Sharia law against me. And they try to promote and they try to sell that idea to all the local masajids.
Sounds like a bit like the old British Empire, divide and rule.
Yeah, divide and rule. And then they use this as against me. They're not used only first time. They try to put me on a terrorist list in 2019 when I was on my way to attend the Kashmir conference.
Well, look,
Nations.
Can we cut to the chase? Why did they arrest you this time?
They said that one of the local politically figure, he was the ex-councillor, and he's a sitting chairman of one of the local mosques. I do not want to mention his name. He said he feel that they have a threat from me for their masjid committee, few individuals, but I was very clear they are playing dirty game with me.
So what, did they come round to your house and arrest you, or was it while you were out and about?
No, I was in a local mosque. I was supposed to be praying my prayer, but that individual who have a long-standing grudges against me politically, we were both in a different political party, and we have a both different idea. He called himself a local leader, and he always on a local media, but he did not represent a Muslim community. He is self-promoted leader. So he always used these kind of dirty.
So what did the police tell you they were arresting you for?
That I make a suspicious, malicious threat. So, and they bring Islamic law.
Oh, right. What? So in Islamic law?
Yeah, Islamic Sharia law. To be honest, the same gentleman who he bring, let me, the same gentleman who said this is a Sharia law, he was one of the speaker before my protest, before 3 days ago. Let me correct that. And he, you know, the person who said this is against the Sharia, he was with me till when the protest was on the 22nd of October. Then he decided that this is against the Sharia law. When he finally find out that this protest, he will not able to attend, he will not able to get a speaker as a speaker, then he brings
so
Islamic law.
Yeah. So sounds to me like he just wants to be in charge.
Yes.
And if he's not, he's going to invoke some excuse. A bit like Marvin, the mayor. Anyway, look, lovely to meet you, Bushra.
You.
Very, very good. Good to have you in the studio. We're going to hear now from Zahra Sultana, who spoke on Wednesday during the debate about the Gaza ceasefire.
Yusuf and his two older siblings counted themselves lucky. Their dad, a radiographer at the local hospital in Khan Yunis, had installed solar panels at their house. So even when their neighbourhood lost power, they could still watch their favourite cartoons. That's what they were doing when an airstrike hit from Israel. Miraculously, Yusuf's brother Hamid was unharmed. His sister Juri was found in the rubble. She was injured, but alive. Yusuf's mother searched in vain for her youngest son. She went to the hospital, asking if anyone had seen her handsome and curly-haired boy. It was Yusuf's dad who found him. His body had been taken to the morgue. Yusuf was 7 years old when killed. His dream was to be a doctor when he grew up. On his final day, he ran and hugged his dad before he left for work. Yusuf kissed me and said goodbye, his dad recalled. Madam Deputy Speaker, Yusuf is one of the more than 4,600 children and more than 11,000 Palestinians of all ages who have been killed in Israel's assault in Gaza. When the World Health Organization says a Palestinian child is being killed every 10 minutes, Yusuf was one of those 10 minutes. And Madam Deputy Speaker, behind every number you read, behind every horrifying statistic you hear, there were hopes and dreams just as real, just as valuable as yours or mine. And I can't believe it has to be said, but it clearly does. Palestinian lives matter just as much as anyone else's. Israel's assault on Gaza has now killed one in every 200 Palestinians in the besieged enclave. Hospitals, ambulances and refugee camps have been targeted. Premature babies in incubators. Let me repeat that. Premature babies in incubators are dying today because hospitals have run out of fuel. In the illegally occupied West Bank, where Hamas is not in power, around 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces or armed settlers. Madam Deputy Speaker, we could spend all day listing the horrors which the likes of the United Nations Secretary General, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have said amount to clear violations of international humanitarian law and war crimes. The truth is, Israeli officials have been very open about their own intent. At the beginning of the assault, an Israeli military spokesperson said that the emphasis in bombing was on, and I quote, damage, not accuracy. A former head of the National Security Council said, and again I quote, that the aim was to make Gaza a place where no human being can exist. This weekend, an Israeli government minister said that the war, and again I quote, would be Gaza's Nakba, a reference to the 1948 catastrophe where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homelands and never allowed to return. Madam Deputy Speaker, none of this is to downplay Hamas's appalling killing of Israeli civilians. I condemned that, already, and I do it again today, and I repeat the calls for the release of all hostages. But like the UN Secretary General said, none of those crimes excuse what we have seen since. And unlike those crimes, Israel's assault on Gaza has been done with this government's unequivocal support and complicity, and almost certainly with British-made arms. I can see smirking happening on the front bench. Don't think it's a laughing matter, personally speaking. So when the government refuses to support a ceasefire, it gives Israel the green light to continue its slaughter of innocent Palestinians. When it refuses to support a ceasefire, it is refusing to push back against Israeli politicians and policies that aim to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their lands. And Madam Deputy, Mr. Deputy Speaker, I am horrified, utterly horrified, that after all of this, members of this House are still willing to give Israel the green light, proposing nothing more than humanitarian pauses. There is nothing humanitarian about letting children eat a little today, only to bomb them tomorrow. The only humanitarian way forward is an immediate ceasefire, as has been recognised from everyone, from the Pope to the President of France, as well as 76% of the British public, according to polling. So to members across this House, I say this. The children killed in Gaza today could have been saved by a ceasefire agreed yesterday. So I urge you, I implore you, we will be remembered for this vote. So let's be on the right side of history and vote for a ceasefire today. Yeah.
Amazing, really, to hear Zahra Sultana. She's always been one of my favourite MPs, in fact. A Birmingham MP, I think. Am I right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think she is. And she wasn't the only one who gave an excellent speech. And, you know, I just want to hear these things because we hear very, very little of the good. I mean, it's a bit like the old stuff from David Cameron. The mainstream press just ignores all this stuff. But there was another, and that's Leila Moran, which in a way was actually more, she's a Lib Dem MP, more harrowing.
As you will know, this has been an extraordinarily difficult day for many members in this House. But for me, this is the most difficult day I've had to endure in my parliamentary career. We are now over a month on from the atrocious attacks by Hamas on October the 7th, and we were all right to utterly condemn those attacks. But ahead of the votes that we are going to take in a moment, I wanted to let the House know that today I lost my first family member. And the reason why this is important, having spoken about how they are in a church in Gaza City, and how they didn't, I'm afraid, die of a bomb. Instead, they died perhaps for lack of food, perhaps for dehydration. Their health deteriorated in the last week and they couldn't get to the hospital they needed. Today, I wanted to vote for peace. I wanted to be voting for a two-state solution because that's the only way that these horrors will never be seen again. I wanted to vote for getting Hamas out of Gaza. And I wanted to vote for those reasons for an immediate bilateral ceasefire so that families like mine, but also families in Israel, don't have to endure this anymore. I urge colleagues from all sides to bear in mind that this is more than just party politics right now. I have been so disappointed by language I have heard today. The Prime Minister earlier suggesting that we weren't on the side of Israel.
Order, please. Deepest condolences, I'm sure, from the House, but this is clearly not a matter for the Chair. So we'll let the comments that you've made stand. Thank you. No, please resume your seat. This is not a matter for the Chair. So please resume your seat. No, please resume your seat. We have expressed our deepest condolences, but this is not a matter for the Chair and therefore not a legitimate point of order during this debate. Front bench contributions, David Lammy.
Well, Mr. Deputy Speaker, I think the whole House would want to send their deepest condolences to the member for Oxford West and Aberdeen with what we have just heard.
That's Leila Moran MP explaining that one of her members of her family has died in Gaza, Martin. She's shut down there by the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle. As soon as she starts relating this to decisions made by the Prime Minister, as soon as she mentions Sunak's name, he just shuts her up.
Well, I mean, the rules by which these things are done in the British House of Commons.
That isn't really a rule, is it? I mean, he's basically like MI5. He's defending the establishment by shutting her up.
Well, I mean, we need to reform the way we do politics. As things stand, he is the Deputy Speaker and he can make that ruling, can't he? Maybe he shouldn't be making that ruling.
Ode to Dave the Cameron. Dave is back to serve, 'tis true, his masters, and their point of view, a familiar face for all to see, dead man's shoes, foreign secretary. The cabinet is truly hollow, no substance, truth of path will follow. On Gaza's plight as death unfolds, Dave will do just what he's told. Appease, bow down to please Israel. Slap on back as Dave's head swells. Chubby cheeks, weak chin and eyes that look as if he's oft surprised. Snazzy clothes, so very sleek, but deep inside this man is weak. A yes man for each bell that tolls, escaping again when things are spoiled. A man who lives in luxury, 40 million in wealth has he. This post clear, not a commandeer, an order from above they fear. A pit of snakes seems now we've got, a house of cards, each one to rot, a tag team clear in each face we see, their raison d'etre, our sovereignty. Thanks, Patricia.
Lesson, we hear how the king of Babylon sought the help of Daniel to interpret the meaning of the mysterious writing that had appeared on the wall of the royal palace when the king drank from the sacred vessels that had been looted from the temple in Jerusalem. A reading from the book of Daniel, chapter 5, at verse 13. Daniel was brought in before Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. The king said to Daniel, "So you are Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah. I have heard of you that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that enlightenment, understanding, and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and tell me its interpretation, but they were not able to give the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you are able to read the writing and tell me its interpretation, you shall be clothed in purple, have a chain of gold around your neck, and rank third in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered in the presence of the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and let him know the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar kingship, greatness, glory, and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. He killed those he wanted to kill, kept alive those he wanted to keep alive, honored those he wanted to honor, and degraded those he wanted to degrade. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he acted proudly, he was deposed from his kingly throne and his glory was stripped from him. He was driven from human society, and his mind was made like that of an animal. His dwelling was with the wild asses. He was fed grass like oxen, and his body was bathed with the dew of heaven, until he learnt that the Most High God has sovereignty over the kingdom of mortals, and sets it over whomsoever he will. And you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. You have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. The vessels of his temple have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose power is your very breath, and to whom belong all your ways, you have not honored. So from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parthen. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed in purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made concerning him that he should rank third in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Here ends the first lesson.
Like a blinding flare, don't look away, 'cause I'm already in there. I've been there, wherever you stand. I've been there longer than you care to remember. Very deep.
Wow, what a tune that is. Almost feels like the World War III show here. That was Censor from 1994 with The Age of Panic. They're from pretty much near where Nick George's is in Richmond in southwest London, who the guest we had on earlier on. And very, very little heard Censor. But I think we're going to have a bit more. I'll probably pop a couple more Censor tracks on the very end of the show. Before that, we had When I Needed a Neighbour from the Romsey Abbey Choir. Now, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll plunge straight into Human Rights Watch, Martin, warning Gaza communications blackout can cover up atrocities. A United Nations Human Rights Chief says he will launch an investigation into profound breaches of humanitarian law by the Israelis. The blackout of communications is to cover up atrocities, he says.
That's clearly what's going on here. And of course, what the Israelis are doing here is, in many respects, it could be compared to what was going on in Libya and Syria and what was going on with between Serbia and Kosovo. And all three countries, we didn't just put sanctions on them, we went to war with them. The Israelis are basically in that category, the sort of country that instead of just wagging our finger at them, we should put in a no-fly zone, surely, to stop them bombing hospitals.
In a way, what's
That's
happened
what we did in Tripoli.
By the British government setting themselves in support of Netanyahu, they are also really sticking two fingers up at the British population, aren't they? 75% of which absolutely supports the Palestinians.
Well, I think this is the big unspoken in British politics. Ultimately, Tony Blair lost the election to the Tories because even though he managed to scrape home after he'd invaded Iraq, in Bristol, the Liberal Democrats took Labour seats because they'd opposed the war. In actual fact, war and peace is quite close to the hearts of ordinary people in this country because they're not, you know, we used to be an empire and all the rest of it, and we know that these things matter. And therefore, you know, if Britain ends up going to war over what's happening in Gaza, then we will be dragged into all of it, and we will end up with a catastrophe,
what
a
do you
world
make,
war.
What do you make of the restraint of on that point, the restraint of the Lebanese, restraint of other surrounding Arab countries, not really weighing in and allowing these Palestinians to be slaughtered? Because some are saying that actually the whole business of killing these Palestinian people, sweeping them out, it's not just about sweeping them out of the land. It's also a trap to try and widen the war.
Well, that's why they're not overreacting, just as the Russians are not overreacting to the various provocations to which they've been subjected. Ultimately, if you're going to beat a state like the Israeli state, you've got to play smart. You can't. I mean, Hezbollah are actually engaging the Israeli army along the northern border there. The Israelis have had to withdraw the whole population 30 or 40 kilometres back from the border, which means that they may never come back. Yeah? You understand what I'm saying? Hezbollah are saying, right, you can't bring those people back because we will attack them. Now, they're not going all out because that would then provoke the Americans to attack them, which would then bring the Iranians in. And all these things should be thought about by anybody who's involved
in this. Now, The Socialist Worker is not a publication we could talk about much on here, but there's an excellent article in here. British state tries to cover up its military operations in the Middle East. The Socialist Worker has defied a D-notice to the media, a state instruction to remain silent. Along with other newspapers, Socialist Worker received an instruction from the state to cover up its military manoeuvres. Specifically, the D-notice concerned British special forces operating in the Middle East.
Yes, it's undoubtedly the case in my mind that British and US special forces are embedded with the Israeli military. And the justification for this is that some of the people that were taken prisoner by Hamas have got British passports. Therefore, the British government then feels it's justified in sending British special forces to work with the Israelis to try and rescue these people. Although I can't see how indiscriminate bombing of Gaza does anything to rescue them. And in actual fact, as Hamas has pointed out, quite a number of the prisoners have died as a result of Israeli bombing. Just as many of the people died on the day of October the 7th when the IDF shot indiscriminately at everybody.
The Daily Mail has the right sort of contact, says Socialist Worker. It's reported the UK's elite SAS is on standby in Cyprus to rescue British hostages held captive in Gaza by Hamas.
This is the justification for it. But of course, what's actually going on is the British and the Americans and the Israelis are preparing for a showdown with their enemies across the Middle East, partly as a way of trying to cover.
They mean the people that didn't let them overthrow the Syrian government in the Middle East.
Exactly those people, including
the Russians,
including the Syrian Arab Army, who have taken hundreds of thousands of casualties but have carried on fighting because they're fighting for their country. It's not our country, it's their country. And of course, the British think it's okay to send our army all over. You saw what's happened in Australia yesterday. The guy who grassed up the fact that the Australian SAS killed at least 37 unarmed civilians in Australia, in Afghanistan, he is not being allowed to plead public interest defence. So he's probably going to go to prison.
Just for telling the truth.
For telling the truth.
We're to exposing war criminals, a bit like Julian Assange. So, and also an Israeli minister has said dropping a nuclear bomb is an option. He's the same guy we had on last week. He also says that the Palestinians, why don't they go to Ireland? This is in the Irish press.
Well, what they're saying is, we don't want them, why don't you have them? That would be a solution, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what's been going on with Ukraine, for example.
Well, We've taken
hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians.
That's right. Well, I'd turn it on its head and say there's plenty of Israelis who've got dual passports. Many of them have got British passports, like the chap we had on a couple of weeks ago, clearly got a British passport. Maybe it's you that needs to go. Go back to where you came from. Because you weren't born in Israel, were you? Many of these people in the settlements in the West Bank were born in the United States of America. You need to go back to the United States of America. That's where you need to go.
Tony Blair is being touted as a possible peacekeeper for the Middle East, the Daily Telegraph has reported this week. 70-year-old, he's been suggested as a full-time president of Europe by some. Serving as the envoy for the Middle East quartet from 2007 to 2015, Blair was handed the task of helping develop the Palestinian economy, with his role overlapping with Netanyahu's second term. So what about this idea of Tony Blair as a Middle East peace envoy that is acceptable to Netanyahu?
Well, it obviously would be acceptable to Netanyahu, and that's why he's being suggested. But is he acceptable to the British public, who regard him, for the most part, as a war criminal? Because they do. He dragged our country into that war with Iraq, which killed at least a million people, and he dragged our good name through the dirt.
There's a brilliant, I'm going to put a link up to this article, Winter Oak website. The actual writer is Paul Kudinek, and he's talking about another article that he's also quoting from another article by researcher Ben Rubin. He's saying he's looking into the UK charity My Life, My Say, which collaborates closely with the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. It's been building a remote-controlled youth movement similar to the World Economic Forum's Global Shapers to try and shape politics in the UK. Young people who are lucky enough to be addressed by Blair via a large TV screen as he clarified what My Life, My Say described as his ongoing support for the organisation. This sounds like a kind of young global leaders, the idea of tapping people up at a young age and telling them you're going to be a leader, so long as you're compliant. Blair was the main speaker at a conference at the Future of Britain, organised by My Life, My Say, and hosted by the Institute of Global Health Innovation. And he puts all sorts of links up showing pictures of Blair chit-chatting away. But who are the trustees? Well, Rubin has discovered one of the trustees, Glenn Manning, is a senior banker at Rothschild & Company. That's the trustee of My Life, My Say. So Blair is working very closely with Rothschild & Company. And also, this chap has also enjoyed a long career with Rothschild entity JP Morgan.
Well, Tony Blair has made out like a bandit since he left politics. And, of course, he's regarded as very much a safe bear of hands by all the wrong
surely
people.
Surely he's not going to be put into this job, is he? I mean,
he's being suggested for this by the Israelis and by the Western deep state.
I mean, it's a ridiculous suggestion.
He's not acceptable to the other side at all.
Isn't it a ridiculous suggestion? No one's going to take him up on that, are they?
Well, he's being pushed forward as to take flak on behalf of the Israeli government and the US government because he's a reliable piece of their machine. But there's no way that other forces in the Middle East are going to accept Tony Blair as any kind of mediator. I think the West's role in mediation in this Israel-Palestine dispute is coming to an end. the Arab side are going to be looking to the Russians and the Chinese to do the mediation.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe the Turks. Because
maybe the Turks.
Erdogan,
yeah.
That's the next thing to talk about, is Erdogan has made this incredible speech this week referring to the to Israel as a terrorist state. Do you want to explain that?
Well, of course.
What is Turkey's role? Because they're kind of, they are actually being quite fiercely independent from East and West, aren't they?
Well, they're what's called, in technical international relations terms, they're a swing state. So they're in the middle and they're trying to get what they can from various sides of various forces that they're trying to deal with. So they deal with the Israelis in actual fact. You know, they've actually got quite, they're supplying the Israelis with oil, for example. The Turks could easily just cut off Israel's oil supply. They just close down the pipeline. They also deal with the West because they're part of NATO. And therefore, you know, they've got a veto on anything that NATO may or may not do.
I was expecting to see the speech.
And they're also regarded as sensible people to talk to by the Russians. And the Russians have got plenty of reasons to dislike the Turks. But the Russians are very pragmatic. They will talk to Erdogan if they can get what they want from him.
The Turks don't really like the Israelis. They would much rather have that land back, which they lost 100 years or so ago.
Well, the thing is that the Erdogan's rhetoric when he's talking to his political base in the Justice and Development Party is that he's very much hostile to the Israelis, etc., etc. But his actual practice is rather different. He could just cut off their oil supply. He hasn't done it.
Erdogan has called for Israeli leaders to be tried for war crimes at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And saying that Hamas is not a terrorist organisation, but a political party that has won elections. So he's being pretty forthright about. He says also, we will never shy away from voicing the truth that Hamas members are protecting their land, honour and lives in the face of occupation policies. They're resistance fighters. Some people are uncomfortable about this.
Well, I mean, the Justice and Development Party is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is Hamas. And so, therefore, the Muslim Brotherhood, they certainly do regard themselves as legitimate political parties. All this stuff about Hamas as a terrorist organisation has got to be completely extirpated. We discussed that with our Israeli colleague the other week. Hamas is the elected government of Palestine. They were elected in 2006, they won the vote, and then all these people going about the Arab Spring and all the rest of it, in 2006, there was an election in Palestine, and Hamas won it. Now, as the elected government, they can then take the decisions they feel they need to take to deal with the situation they're in, just as the elected government of Britain did in World War II. And in its wisdom, the democratically elected government of Britain decided to bomb Germany's cities back to the Stone Age. Nobody was ever punished for it. And nor should they be, I suppose, because it was a war, and that's what the decision was. Hamas have made the decision that they're going to capture hostages or take prisoners inside Israel. Don't forget that the places where they were taking these prisoners from, their families are buried underneath those settlements. That's where they used to live before 1967 war, when it was all seized by the Israelis and they were pushed back into Gaza. But their families are buried under, just on the other side of the fence there. There is no legitimacy for the Israeli state.
Okay,
to be
so what else does Erdogan say? I will put up a link to his speech on our show page. It's been fascinating to hear this because apparently initially he was quite sympathetic with the Israelis when Hamas initially attacked them on the 7th of October, but he certainly changed his tune. Israel, he says, you have an atomic bomb. You have a nuclear bomb and you're threatening with it. We know this and your end is approaching. It does not matter what you have. You are a goner.
I think what the Israelis have to recognise is that in world wars, tiny little states like Israel could easily be collateral damage.
He goes beyond
won't
that.
Be
he
there says at the end of it.
He says, in short, those who have lost whatever there is related to morals, conscience and dignity can no longer be a human being. They can only be lower even than animals. Now, is this interesting, isn't it? Because it was actually Netanyahu and his far-right cabinet that started describing the Palestinians as animals. Actually, what's happening is Erdogan is turning that right round and saying, well, actually, you're the animals here. Because there's quite a lot of this going on is with the Israelis is calling other people what they are.
Well, I think this is very unfair to animals because animals don't do any of the things.
They don't
do any of these things. It's only people that do this nasty stuff. But I think what's significant.
Actually, some animals do. You know,
well, they don't.
They don't.
It's not on the same scale.
Sort of scale no.
Not on the same scale. I mean, you do get chimpanzee wars, but it's, you know, they're not nearly as brutal as ours. I think the geopolitics of this are absolutely explosive. This, what Hamas have done is a bit like the IRA in 1916 in Dublin, is they forced the issue. And of course, people say, "Well, they shouldn't force the issue. We just want a quiet life." Well, of course, you want a quiet life. Everybody wants a quiet life.
Everyone is watching the Israelis. What are they going to do next? Yeah. I mean, on antiwar.com today, there is a Israel apparently is telling the Palestinians now to evacuate southern Gaza too. So they said, "Go to southern Gaza and you'll be safe." No, you're not going to be safe there. Anyway, we knew they weren't safe because they were bombing them down there. And Israel attacked the Al Shifa hospital to put pressure on Hamas to agree to release the hostages.
Well, I mean, the obvious thing the Israelis could do if they want to save civilian casualties is allow people to flee into Israel. They could put tented communities up on the places where these people's families used to live, and then they can have that land. And that's a solution. It's a humanitarian solution, so that all the Hamas can stay in their tunnels, all the population can just move into what is Israel now. After 1967, you can start off with tent cities, and then you can build houses for them right there.
One of the groups
we
haven't really heard much from over the last few weeks is the Russians, and I've finally found an interview with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister.
The immediate task is to stop hostilities, to stop any military activity, and to take measures to resolve humanitarian problems which are all over the place. This is absolutely necessary first step. We called immediately when the Israeli reaction to the 7th of October massacre became known, we strongly condemned what Hamas did, and at the same time called for measured response in full accordance with international humanitarian law, respecting the international requirements for treatment of hospitals, women, children, other civilians. And as a first step, we suggested to the Security Council the draft resolution calling for immediate ceasefire, cessation of hostilities for humanitarian purposes. It was not supported, first of all, by the United States. Then the developing countries, members of the Security Council, proposed a softer version of a resolution calling not for a ceasefire but for humanitarian truce, which was also killed by the United States. They only were ready to say a humanitarian pause without any commitment to continue these efforts. A humanitarian pause was not something which the Arab and other Muslim countries and greater membership of the United Nations were ready to adopt. So they went to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for humanitarian truce, but it is not being implemented. And the current activities in the Security Council indicate that there is still an interest in having something from the Security Council, especially after the General Assembly has spoken, but the Americans are not going, at least as things stand now, they're not going to accept to let go anything except a humanitarian pause with no commitment to do something else after one-time action. This is the immediate task. I still believe that this is doable. We leave to the authority of the United Nations, United Nations Relief and Work Agencies in Gaza, the efforts to defend their mandates, which are also under huge threat. But when this immediate fight is over, with all the understanding that terrorism cannot be accepted in any form, and that respond to terrorism must be fully in line with international humanitarian law. At the end of the day, as Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, said soon after this started, the attack of Hamas took place not in a vacuum. So the second aspect of this problem, which is much more important, the cessation of hostilities and stopping of violence, is of huge importance to the civilians. But in historical terms, in sustainable settlement terms, the creation of Palestinian state is unavoidable. And the discussions which are taking place around the future of Gaza, most of them avoid concentration on the implementation of resolutions of the Security Council to create a Palestinian state next to Israel, living in peace and security, coexisting with Israel in peace and security. Borders were indicated as being 1967 borders, capital is Jerusalem. All this has never been cancelled by the United Nations.
Well, you can see Lavrov there sticking to the two-state solution, which was agreed in Oslo all those years ago. And I don't suppose that they're going to change that position in the short term. But my own view is that the Israelis have now gone too far, and that they cannot expect to negotiate about the 1967 borders anymore. We're now talking about the 1948 borders, because the 1967 borders are only accepted by the Arab side on the basis that the Israelis were going to accept a Palestinian state.
Yeah, and start behaving themselves.
Yes, yeah. And if they're not going to do that, then the 1967 borders are not under discussion anymore.
Give them an inch.
We're going back to talk about the 1948 borders.
Giving them an inch, they'll take a mile.
Yeah, so in other words, what needs to happen, as what's happened in Yugoslavia, is that the Israelis have to go back behind the line that was originally agreed in 1948. It certainly didn't include Jerusalem. No Jewish settlers are supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. That was the original United Nations resolution in 1948, was they were not to have Jerusalem.
Well, the main
in other words,
here,
it was not to be a state based on what you might call biblical. It was going to be a Jewish state for Jewish people in the Holy Land, but it wasn't to include Jerusalem, because everybody realised that that would be absolutely provocative.
I did a piece,
but there they are.
Martin.
They've moved the embassy to British, not the British embassy, but the US embassy has been moved to Jerusalem, which is completely against the spirit of the 1948 agreement.
Netanyahu and the Greater Israel Bloc, I won't call them Zionists, because so many of the Zionists are against Netanyahu now. He's just turned their dream to a total nightmare, many of them, saying that these are not really God's chosen people. They're obviously not by the... Just look at their actions.
Well, I don't want to go into who's chosen by God. Let's just talk about what the rules are for international politics.
But this is a cover, isn't it, really? It's quite a lot of chutzpah here. They're saying, oh, it's okay, God's given us this land, God's telling us what to do.
Well, the original agreement with the Zionist movement to give them a state in 1948 wasn't based on anything to do with
the
Bible.
Martin, I'm trying to drill down into their thinking, you know, the elite psychos. What do they think? What makes them think what they think? Here, it's just, well, God has given us this, and God is our witness, and we don't have to take any notice of anybody else. This whole idea of a racial thing, David Livingston starts to look at in a little while, but I'd like to look now at the wider possibility of a much wider war, bringing in the United States and the Russians or the Chinese or both,
or the Iranians,
and particularly a possible nuclear war. There's a fascinating interview. I found it fascinating anyway. It's going to take quite a little while for me to tidy it up so you only get the English bits. It was not live translation. It was this colonel, Vladimir Trukhan, Russian colonel, discussing the possibility of nuclear war with the United States this week, in fact. It was called a Ukraine War Update, and here's a little excerpt.
A new system uses principles not seen before in the weapons. The rocket artillery and heavy flamethrowers have reached almost to perfection. No one else has a heavy flamethrower systems, which doesn't leave any chances on a square kilometer, even for a Groundhogs. In regards to strategic deterrence, to hypersonics, it has already been prepared before the SMO. So when we talk about the nuclear deterrence, it should be noted that the United States has a very inconvenient geology. The use of nuclear weapons on Russia may burden the life, while the use of nuclear weapons on United States continent may destroy the continent. That's how they got created those lands, nothing personal.
Is that to do with, you mentioned the geology, what is it about the geology of North America that would be so, would cause a nuclear strike to have such disastrous consequences?
Yellowstone caldera.
The what? Sorry, I didn't get that.
The Yellowstone volcano, or caldera.
Oh, the Yellowstone volcano, right, okay. Oh, wow, okay.
Also, the majority of United States population is located at the east and west coast, except for the Rust Belt, which we see as more friendly, maybe. Modern sea weaponry may invoke a tsunami both on the Pacific and Atlantic shores, with the wave height up to 500 meters.
Последствия можете оценить сами.
You may judge the consequences yourself.
500 meters, wow. So, do you mean to say that the Yellowstone volcano would erupt if a nuclear strike were to come into contact with it?
Not only volcano, but adhering areas. Not a single weapon can catch up to the natural catastrophe. We don't want that because the whole world is going to suffer.
So, in effect, a nuclear strike could cause a chain reaction, which would then cause natural disasters. Is that what you mean?
Those assertions do exist. That's why a completely new type of nuclear weapon has been developed, which can be used on the shores of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. There is no alternatives to this weapon. That's why United States government have some things to think about.
Well, that's the Russian Colonel Vladimir Trukhan, Martin, with a few home truths about the distance they are ahead of the United States, talking also about using nuclear weapons to trigger the Yellowstone caldera volcano and possibly cause enormous disruption in America by earthquakes, by getting that fault line open again, and also this incredible half a kilometre high waves triggered by nuclear weapons on the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast, which would wipe out cities on the American coastline.
Well, I'm sure these things are true, but of course, at the same time, the Americans have the capacity to completely destroy civilization in continental Russia.
Do you think that some of the people who are taking on the Palestinians, they're taking on the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, they're now calling them the enemy, they don't want to talk to them, realize what they're letting themselves in for here?
Well, the danger for humanity is that we will end up in a nuclear exchange here, just as the danger was in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And of course, there are more factors, there are more moving parts in this crisis than there were in 1962.
Well, what we heard from James Files was that actually the whole Cuban Missile Crisis was already sorted out before it began. The main reason that the news went around the world about the Cuban Missile Crisis being such a crisis was to save the American face as they quietly withdrew their missile from Interlik in Turkey.
I don't suppose James Files, as a low-level mafia shooter, knew what was going on.
No, he was in touch with CIA people
at
the time.
Yes, I know, but the CIA people wouldn't necessarily know what was going on between Khrushchev and Kennedy.
What he's saying is that even before the whole crisis erupted to the public, the Americans had agreed that they were going to have to, in order to stop these weapons being installed in Cuba, withdraw the nuclear weapons from Turkey, and they didn't want to admit that to the public.
Well, they didn't admit it to the public. The deal that Khrushchev did with Robert Kennedy, on behalf of John F. Kennedy, was that they would withdraw the missiles and then that the Americans would withdraw their missiles from Turkey, but that the Russians wouldn't make any kind of comment about that so that the Americans could save face.
Yeah.
Okay, that is on the record.
We can definitely agree.
That is on the record.
We can definitely agree about that. But anyway, now it's time to look back into, and I did promise to try and do this last week, to David Livingstone, looking at the origins of Zionism. And he says it goes back a long, long way. And the origin of the whole concept of creating this crusader state, which the British did after the Second World War, goes back thousands of years.
There's a specific strain of Kabbalah we need to look at. So Kabbalah, of course, is a set of mystical doctrines. They can feature, this is what I've been, really the core aspect of my research has been trying to pinpoint exactly when they emerged, and I pinpoint that to the 6th century BC in Babylon. So, I mean, and so there's really this history, right? So we can summarize it in a few minutes. So basically, God asks Abraham to sacrifice his child. In the Bible, it's Isaac. But at the last second, he is saved by an angel and asked to sacrifice a lamb instead. And because of his devotion, God makes a promise with him. He promises that, he says, you know, he asks him to look out and all the land that he can see will be inherited by his descendants. There will be many, many, many. So Isaac has a son named Jacob, who's later named Israel, who has 12 sons. They end up in Egypt, and they are there for, according to the Bible, approximately 400 years. And then they are rescued by Moses, who brings them back to the Holy Land. There eventually, what happens, you have a series of, well, the first problem that happens is that when they are commanded to conquer, according to the Bible, conquer the land of Palestine, and this is the justification that the Zionists are using, to basically slaughter the inhabitants and to remove them, that they were warned that to avoid falling into the worship of the gods of those people. The idea was that they were God's chosen people, and God basically said to them, you know, he chose them above all the nations, that they, you know, of all the qualities that they had, that if they, all they had to do was follow the Ten Commandments, they would be examples for humanity, and the whole world would regard them as leaders. But I'll get to this point later, is how they bastardized that idea. So basically what happens is that they enter Canaan, and within a very short time, they start practicing the cult of the Canaanites, which is the worship of Baal and Astarte, which also includes elements like astrology and magic and things like that. Well, actually, that came later. But anyway, so the story of the Bible from the time of the Exodus to the captivity is the story of various prophets being constantly sent to try to reform the Jews, to return to the true religion, to the worship of Yahweh, God, and to the practice of the adherence to the Ten Commandments. But there they don't. It's basically, you know, as a whole, it's a culture that had completely veered away from Judaism, even the temple itself, so it would be like the equivalent of the Vatican becoming a pagan temple. The temple of Solomon itself was turned into a pagan temple. And so the warnings came several times that if they continued those ways, they would be taken into captivity. So what happens in 597? The Babylonians come. Before that, what happens is that the Assyrians come and they conquer the northern kingdom of Israel and send those people off into captivity. They become, you know, from that point forward, the lost tribes. The lower kingdom of Judah is conquered again, I said, in 597. They are taken into captivity in Babylon. And this is where they come in contact with the teachings of the ancient Magi, known to the world as ancient Magi. But basically what happens is that they come into contact with the teachings of astrology and numerology and magic, which they incorporate with their religion of Baal. But now, instead of practicing their cult outwardly, they turn it into, they disguise it as a mystical interpretation of Judaism, which becomes the Kabbalah. And so they, how the Kabbalah is effectively, it's a Gnostic version of Judaism, so it reverses everything. So where God becomes bad and the devil becomes good, the devil becomes the liberator of humanity. And so they follow the same entire sort of, you know, the whole basic teachings and expectations of the end times, with the expectations of a prophet to come to install them, to gather them back and to lead them from Jerusalem. But they see it in reverse. So the first thing that happens is that Cyrus conquers, I think in 538 BC, and allows the Jews to return to Palestine, where they rebuild the temple. This becomes now the second temple. That temple then is finally destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, and that's the end. And then this is the beginning of the diaspora, when the Jews are required to live in exile all this time. And ever since that time, the majority of Jews have been still hoping for the coming of their Messiah and their return to Zion, or the Holy Land. The problem is that within the Jewish community, you have a certain group, more radical wing, who are followers of the Kabbalah, who have a more distorted view of it. And this is where you get the idea that, so according to the mystical teachings, so of the Kabbalah, the Jews are the chosen people. But what that means effectively is that they are, history is laid out for their purpose, and that non-Jews are expendable and effectively not human.
Well, this is, I think, a fascinating line that David Livingstone has uncovered here. His book, The Dying God, looks into, it's quite an old book, but he's saying, one of the things he always says to me, and I'll put the full version of this interview up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, is that the more he looks into this, the more he finds. It's like an absolute gold mine, looking into this long history of the battle between the Judeo-Christian faiths and the Gnostic versions of them, or the mystical versions, or the Canaanite-occupied versions of those faiths. He also goes on to talk about how the whole idea of the Aryan race is something that was dreamt up. And I think that him looking at this idea of why the whole idea of Jewishness has become this thing about a country and a race rather than a religion. And this is also something that the Kabbalah talks about. But he finished up by talking to me about the situation now in Gaza, and about the strength of Freemasonry and the B'nai B'rith, which is a sort of Jewish version of Freemasonry, in Britain and the USA. I asked him about why it is that Britain and America are so supportive of Israel, even though what we're seeing is so barbarous.
Well, it's not going to happen, because effectively we've got working in the background Freemasonry and another order, which is the B'nai B'rith, which is basically sort of a quasi-Masonic Zionist version of Freemasonry. What's interesting is a friend of mine just happened to send me today by a French lecturer who's talking about agents of the Mossad, basically a branch of Mossad agents that are called Sayanim. And these are basically unpaid agents, effectively, not on the payroll, but who sort of volunteer to contribute to the Zionist cause. So you're looking basically at, you know, this is how you explain people like Palmerston. Ms. Palmerston was working with Mazzini. Right? In fact, they call him, in fact, Palmerston is effectively considered to have guided Mazzini. You have people like Lord Shaftesbury, who was the first one to make an open call for the return of Jews to Zion, to the land of Zion, Holy Land, working as well with Palmerston. You know, so yes, you're basically looking at, and you know, this is why this is how the whole idea of this maintaining this idea of Jewish power is necessary, and this is why the protocols are necessary, because they use the perception of their power to their advantage, and I don't know if I'll be able to find it, but this is basically advice given by Chaim Weizmann, something to the effect that, you know, we're even though we're not as powerful as they think they are, we need to continue to let them think that. So, you know, what you can imagine is that many times you're looking at people like Lord Balfour, another member of the Round Table. These are, you know, the thing is that the Zionists have the Rothschilds as their chief backers. So, you know, we don't hear about it, but likely what happens is that, you know, countries are threatened, like Britain in particular would have been threatened, that either they're offered favors or they're offered threats that the Rothschilds would be able to affect with the power at their control. You know, like there's a famous line, I haven't been able to substantiate it, but something to the effect where Rothschild said, you know, I don't care what puppet rules as long as I've got control of the money, you know, money supply. And so they can ease, they pull the levers, so they're able to easily make threats or promises that are powerful enough to induce, you know, whatever country to do their bidding.
Well, that's right. I mean, someone like Gordon Brown, you know, in 2008 being told, you know, either you're going to give the banking system a massive bailout or else the whole lot's going to come crashing down. Well, he, you know, exactly. He does exactly what he's told.
Tough choice. Yeah.
Well, look, finally, David, fascinating insight into how we got here. From what you know and from your reading of their plans, effectively, yeah. Whereabouts is this all heading? What's the object of it all?
Let me read exactly what Ben-Gurion said. In fascinating, he says it all. He said that it's in a speech in 1962. Okay, so he basically said he shared his vision for the future. He said the image of the world in 1987 has traced in my imagination. : The Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure of the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising their standard of living may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the increasing influence of the workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states having a socialist and democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state. All other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, in brackets, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind, to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah.
I mean, it looks like we're heading for a much more chaotic version than Ben-Gurion was prophesying there.
Well, it's, yeah, well, sure. So, you know, the some of the political background is a little off, but the point there is that it's a United Nations with a seat in Israel as fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Okay? So this is what they've been working on for 2,000 years. Right? You know, in at least this one group who have their particular Kabbalistic interpretation. They're trying to fulfill Bible prophecy, which they believe claims that they will be. In fact, you know, I took a course in Hebrew Bible at university by it was taught by a Jewish rabbi, and he could basically try to, you know, it took me a while to realize that he was trying to teach us that the covenant was the underlying theme of the Old Testament. And finally, I asked him, okay, well, then what's the point? He said, well, he said, in the end, he said, the Messiah will return and the Jews will rule the world in peace. No, it's a fundamental Zionist belief. So this is what I don't know why, I assume this is obvious to most people, but that's what they're working for. They want to rebuild the third temple, right? They're working to, the whole point of Zionism is to return the Jews to Israel as a fulfillment of Bible prophecy to establish Jerusalem as the seat of a world government.
Well, that's David Livingstone there. Full interview will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk, just about an hour altogether, talking about the whole emergence of the whole Zionist project and making some reference also to the Crusades, which was a similar thing back in medieval times, where these big European aristocrats and the Catholic Church did a quite a good job of trying to take over the Holy Land. Martin, you wanted to comment a bit on that?
I think it's interesting to look into all these byways of, you know, the way human societies have thought about their structure. And I think it's the Ben Gurion there is speaking as a kind of, you know, sort of utopian socialist almost. He wasn't particularly religious. The influence of the Jews who went to Persia and then came back under the Persian Empire too, you know, Cyrus famously let them come back. This was only the elite of the Jewish society. The poor farmers who basically lived in Palestine in those days, they were under the thumb of the Jewish elite. The Jewish elite gets run out by the Persians and then brought back. But the poor farmers eventually rebelled against Roman rule. They were the backbone of the uprisings against Roman rule. They were put down, and then of course the elite again was dispersed around the Roman Empire. But the genetic facts are that today's Palestinians, including those who live in Gaza and the West Bank, are the genetic inheritors of the original Jewish population.
What he's talking about.
They are the original Jews. They converted to Islam when Islam took over. Some Palestinians are Greek Orthodox because they converted to Greek Orthodoxy during the Roman Empire. The majority of them ultimately converted to Islam, but genetically they are the descendants Jews who lived in Palestine.
They were often forced to convert to Islam anyway. But the point really here, I think, David's making is that there it's like a kind of religious cult, the Israeli project. Basically, the whole idea of the Israeli government is like a religious cult. It's got these hidden religious motives behind it, and it's important to understand them and expose them to understand the motives of what's going on. It also seems to me that there's this kind of parallel. I mean, the idea is that there is an underground motive, which is about real estate and creating war, but it's sold using this kind of Ben-Gurion vision of, this is going to be great here. I think what's happened is it's become absolutely clear over the last few decades, and particularly over the last few weeks, that the real dream and the real vision was a lie, probably right from the start. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Bushra Ali from our local Bristol 4 Palestine, as well as Nick Georges from Palestine Action. Action, folks, actually doing something rather than just talking like we do. And also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share interviews there and elsewhere, maybe via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page that I can use next week, potentially. And you'll find the podcast, this podcast, the full-length interviews, And story links in the comment page at our email address. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We're just asking for people to subscribe if they possibly can at the moment, because Bristol City Council and our marvellous Marvin the Mayor has been putting pressure on them to pay some sort of full business rates, even though, of course, it's not a business here, it's a charity. So they are looking to try and make a little bit more of an income, and any of the donations that we get will go to them if they need it. So I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can get my books via eBay. One is The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is occult secret government since the English Civil War, including quite a bit about the assassination of Princess Diana. Not actually carried out specifically by our wife murdering King Charles, but obviously with his collusion, and because she was being a bit of an embarrassment to him and the royal family. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and it's moved to a later slot, I think, now on Sunday at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. So we've been streaming live from PRSC in Bristol and on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic whatevers get you down.
Make the switch. Hunter Butcher in the picture. Time to make the switch, yo.